We shall stick to the presentations. I want to ask members to make notes, and then towards the end, we will then ask questions to those various presenters. We might also consider to make our break a little bit shorter, if it's possible to bring in other people. But we've got a deadline, people are flying back, so we cannot go beyond the published time. So thank you very much. I'm not going through the procedures. We've presented ourselves for the last 2 days to everyone, and we are becoming like a family on this third and last day for public hearings. Mr. Anthony Rees and Nomsi Matlamini is here from the traditional National Health Alliance, and they will kick off their presentation, and they will have, because Matlamini is with Anthony Rees today, I'll give them a few minutes more, but I want them to conclude then in 25 minutes. Mr. Rees, all over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the Honourable Committee and other members present here today. Tokozane to those traditional healers who are present with us today. I'm going to start this off with introducing Nomsi Matlamini, who is a traditional healer from our Western Cape region, very influential in traditional medicine circles. She's a member of one of our alliance organization partners, of which we are an umbrella group. And I'll pass on to Nomsi.
Thank you so much. I'm Nomsi. I'm Matlamini. I was just born Tembisa Skab. I'm with this forum of Western Cape Nyangi Forum and this alliance of South African traditional health practitioners as doctors. I'm gonna just talk about what I'm gonna do. So about as I'm a traditional healer. We are just opening the land of the ceremony first with our prayer. So if we can just have that prayer. Thank you, God, that we are here. Just give us that land. Protect us with the white light of the Holy Spirit. And give this us our day. And all of us, we are just coming. Everything must just go on. Thank you so much. To start with, the ways indigenous knowledge should be used indigenously by indigenous people, not by foreign companies who will take the knowledge overseas. One, the knowledge is taken away we will have no control or oversight if what they do with our knowledge from South Africa. We cannot trust that the benefits promised by the IKS bill will materialize, as the companies who will take our knowledge will be outside of Africa. We, the healers, have not been consulted on this bill. We are not scientists, nor technologists. Why should we be regulated by these departments or departments of science and technology? Our ancestors pass on knowledge to us, knowledge which has been passed on for hundreds of thousands of moon cycles, over thousands of generations. The knowledge is passed on with only one thing in mind, that it be used to heal and give something to eat for the families, not for profit. this is not the only thing we are left with. This is the only thing we are left with. To be a healer is an honor and a great responsibility, not business. To sell our knowledge for profit will anger our ancestors, and true healer will not sell our knowledge if we do our ancestral will. I will draw with their support, and we left knowledgeless. What kind of a good law says if you don't register will face 3 years in jail? I think one will choose jail than angering the ancestors. As a traditional healer who respect the honor bestowed on us as healers, we know that there are good healers and bad healers. There are also people making decisions for us who are not healers at all. This is unacceptable. We must not trade our knowledge for profit. If we do so, we are all doomed. Lastly, but not least, there is a great difference between a wizard or a witch and a traditional healer. The knowledge belongs to us from our ancestors and people which we serve. I don't think there are people who have the right to sell our ancestral properties to people we don't know and trust. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nomsi Matlamini, for that input. Just to remind you, there are people from the department and obviously the committee, they will make notes. And thank you for your comments. Therese, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Many people ask me, as a European descendant, why I'm involved with trying to protect traditional knowledge rights. I have a strong calling to protect this ancient calling and healing sector through 25 years personally of being involved in herbal medicine as a herbalist. I have a foot in both worlds, the scientific and the traditional. I am a medical herbalist, a person who's trained in the pharmacology of plants, etc., and was registered with the Allied Health Professions Council back in 1991. I was also registered with two different traditional healers groups in South Africa, and it goes right back to 1994. You can actually see the evidence of my registration at that time. So I've been very much involved, and I've been witnessing a tremendous amount of biopiracy going on in this country, where academia specifically have been involved in the wholesale pillaging of traditional knowledge systems for eventual or potential profiteering at the end of the day, in collaboration with pharmaceutical companies, biotechnology companies, etc. If you look at the frenzy of which bioprospecting has developed over the last 10, 15 years. It all started back when at the University of Cape Town, where the pharmacology department was given a database by a German-held company in South Africa that pulled out during the sanctions, who handed over an extensive TRAMED, or traditional medicine database, to the public. It was donated to the public through the university as custodian. That database, in all essence, was hijacked by the pharmacology department, by the then chair of the Medicines Control Council at the time, Professor Peter Volpe, and his crew at the Traditional Medicines Unit, who were looking for anti-malarial drugs, etc., from plant knowledge. And this has spread through various academia in this country, and it's become to a point where almost every university has a unit of some description doing traditional medicine research in South Africa. What saddens me most is the real custodians and people who use traditional medicine on a daily basis, i.e. traditional healers who serve approximately between 70 and 80% of our population with these substances as their primary medicine, are secondary to the profit-driven agenda of this bill. If you look at this bill and you weigh it up, I believe it's a thinly veiled attempt to further entrench biopiracy through giving mere crumbs off the table to the communities when the big companies who come in and get involved take the bread off the table and leave the country. I'm very concerned about this, and it hasn't been properly addressed. There's been a lot of problems with consultation. There are numerous traditional healer groups who are national groups who have been invited to these little ad hoc meetings, and everything's nice at these meetings, but as we've heard from other speakers, those communities have to go back to their communities. They have to consult broadly with their communities. Things like traditional medicine and knowledge systems are integral to the fabric of people's life. And making decisions that will ultimately control and regulate these things needs a lot of thought and insight and wisdom from the people. And we don't believe that has come through in this bill. We believe this bill has taken a very Eurocentric approach to regulating things in a way that is disrespectful of the culture. The cultural milieu of traditional medicine, and I talk from the access point of traditional medicine, I'm not talking from other things which I don't know about, artistic expressions, etc. This is my field. There needs to be more consultation. There are numerous groups in this country, as I've said, who have not been included in the dialogue in the drafting of this bill. Some of them will be here today, who will be giving testimony later during the day that I know of. My submission is very long, and we have got a short period of time, so I'm just making an impassioned plea to you to read the documentation which I've submitted. If you have any further questions, feel free to either call me back, write to me, and I will oblige you. In summary, I have to say that for all the reasons detailed in this written submission that I make, and many more not included for the sake of sticking to the salient issues and that I've just pointed out and the time frame that we have, we cannot in good conscience or respect for our ancestors and future generations support this bill in its current form at all. We will reject it. We will not register our members, and we will not obey. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rees. You are quite clear with regard to the opinion. I just want to ask members to make notes so that we can ask questions with regard to that. But thank you very much for your written statements. Obviously, then we will take cognizance of that. But thank you very much for being so straightforward and telling us, you know, your point of view. And thank you for keeping to the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next presentation will be Mr. Sandile Mchichi. He is here. He was not here when I opened the meeting. We've got 10 presentations today, so we would like people to stick to their time. According to the program, you've got 20 minutes. I know it's difficult, and it's not in the spirit of indigenous knowledge, you know, to rush people. But unfortunately, we've got a time constraint for the day, and we've got many presentations. So, Mr. Mchichi, we are willing and eager to listen to you. Can you just tell us who you are and where you're from and why you are in front of us?
Okay. I am Sandy Mshiki from Kagiso in Mogale City, next to the cradle of humankind, where appropriately and significantly the topic that I'm going to talk about, the indigenous games, were firstly and presumably played by our ancestors.
Mr. Mshiki, just draw the mic a little bit closer to yourself.
Oh, okay. I'm a visionary and a serial innovator. I'm both a qualified primary school teacher and a marketer. In 1993, in partnership with then Hugo Verlin Mafer, we did some viability and feasibility research which showed positive results regarding these indigenous African games. And then in 1994, I registered traditional games CC in order to preserve, protect and promote our indigenous knowledge systems through these indigenous games and or sports. I have received about 10 local and international awards, citations and business achievements, and also represented South Africa at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival in 1999 in Washington, D.C., showcasing Africa's indigenous games. So this is just an abstract paper where I just recommend and show the usage of technology for the development, that is the manufacturing of the different indigenous games equipment, structures, pitches, in order to protect some of them. That is, the topic says indigenous games products for development and modification, their opportunities. Through the DTI's CEDA-funded and driven initiative, similar to the recently launched industrialist initiative, let companies be opened, managed in order to create employment for indigenous locals to manufacture, market, and sell the different indigenous games, equipment, structures, and pitches as per the Department of Sports and Recreation's specifications, which fortunately I have in my possession. Let us, through either Invotech or the CSIR and the Tshwane University of Technology, develop virtual software and hardware for smartphones, iPads that will enable gamers to access and play these indigenous games for free with minimum data usage, not forgetting consoles for TV play. When we visit our public parks, if ever you see a solid state of them being barren or suffocated by Eurocentric recreational structures, as if we don't have our own, of which both adults and youth enjoy playing, let us vigorously manufacture these immovable structures and pitches, then install them in those parks. They will beautify these places, and also they have minimum or no maintenance at all, thus saving the municipalities or metros and the ratepayers a lot of money. When visiting hospitals, you see patients lazing about, frustrated at just sitting and doing nothing. This exacerbates their sickly status. Let us install immovable indigenous grains there, and their livelihood and healing process will speedily improve, as per psychologists and physiotherapists that I've spoken to in the past can attest. Clinics must also benefit from this initiative where possible. Through some of the universities, let us do research of how, where, when these commodities evolved, where possible. This will enable and make it easy for us to write a wholesome book about the subject. The book will have volumes in progressive years about our games and or sports. We must invite, engage and collaborate with other African countries or in the diaspora in this, as there is no one book that is available throughout the world narrating about our games. The one big volume book that I read during our research on world recreational games only mentioned Mankala as our game. Books by other white people from old, do mention Murabaraba here and there, but some claim it as originating from Europe, and they call it 12 man morals. And our Khati or Ugabe is being claimed by America as double Dutch. Please let us correct this, as the damage is irreparable for the continent and for our future generations. Through the same institutions in part two above, let these institutions convert two indigenous games that I have in mind into casino game machines and arcade game machines for these lucrative multi-billion rand industries worldwide. Because we contribute zero to this, and yet we have the products. Let all relevant museums nationally display these games openly with explanations about them. And eventually, let us build an African Toys and Games Museum similar to what Japan's Tokyo Toy Museum is. If you can see that, people, you'll really envy with what the Japanese are doing to protect their indigenous knowledge system. Let us engage and collaborate with either the Lion King or Umoja, that they make some of the relevant games their merchandise. This will create easy access for these commodities into retail stores, because they've got no merchandise, that is, these musicals. Let us promote the immovable games by installing them in our primary and high schools, early childhood development center, public swimming pools, and encourage market them for installation and usage at malls, churches, and child-friendly restaurants. Let some entrepreneurs open up outlets that will rent out some of these indigenous game equipment pitches for youth functions, corporate or government functions, kids' birthday parties, similar to what Josie Keith is doing. We should engage and fund the mass crafting of wooden, granite, and glass games as artifacts, and utilize woodworking NPOs or NGOs like Epilepsy SA and others to create jobs for the disabled locals of South Africa. Let us lobby corporate companies to either sponsor or through corporate social investments to buy for ECD center schools and or install these in parks to market themselves. Let us develop beautiful TV props from some of our games for different and exciting interactive TV game shows, unlike what we see today. Let us encourage and show the Department of Justice the benefits of using interactive games like the Ghetto and Murabaraba to entice and make kids at ease to open up during court cases that involve kids, unlike using dolls and cars. Lastly, let Parliament have a legislation that will ban or stop the buying of indigenous games equipment by the Department of Basic Education, schools, and the Department of Sports and Recreation from a company called Segas, as this company imports them from India, and the country loses millions, if not billions, because of this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Masiki. Thank you for that angle. You know, there's always something new you can learn about this, but thank you very much for that. And I think you're making a very valid point. I think the Department of Arts and Culture must also look at, you know, your presentation. And the notes have been made with from the officials in Science and Technology, and they will obviously also... I know that the Department of Sport and Recreation are definitely involved with your games, but thank you very much for that. Can I ask you as well, you've given us a very short written statement. Will you be able to make available your input today to the Secretary so that we can make it part of our package when we finally deliberate on the issue?
Yes. In fact, some input will also be made during the question and answer because, like I say, I haven't included issues on the protection and the management. Okay? So they were just that because of the time that has been allocated. I just said, no, let me just give them a synopsis on this multi-billionaire rand industry, which we contribute nothing to the world, yet we have the product.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for that
thank
point.
You.
I think it's well received. Okay. Thank you. You're the second people, you know, we're waiting for a translator. The translator is not here yet to assist us. So Mr. Van Breda, is the translator there?
Yes, I'm here, but for Setswana, present us.
Okay.
Can I go?
But then we can proceed. Mr. Rees? Please do so. Mr. Nitsi Malau and Mrs. Dikileri Moshipa, are you here? And are you ready to speak to us? You know that there's going to be a translation. So I hope that you have made contact with your translator so that when you speak, you must pause so that he can translate for us. But please try to keep within your time limit. I know it takes time when we translate, and I will give you a little bit of my indulgence with regard to that. But thank you. Over to you and welcome.
Nna ke tlile go bua ka moetlo wa setso sa rona sa Batswana.
I'm going to talk about our Tswana tradition.
Ke tlo go bua ka motswetse, ka motswetse.
I'm going to talk about the woman who has just given birth.
Mosadi fa a fetsa go be go tshola ngwana o beiwa mo phaposing ya gagwe a le nosi.
After giving birth, a woman who has just given birth is kept in her special room alone.
Ka moetlo wa rona re go na le thobane e re biang fa monyako go bontsha gore ke sesupo sa gore re na le motswetse ka fa lapeng.
In our culture or our tradition, we have a stick which we will put across the door to show that in this area or in this house we are having a woman who has just given birth. In our culture, if one has attended a funeral, on your coming back from the funeral, you are not allowed to enter into the room where the lady or the woman who has just given birth is kept. The woman who has just given birth is not allowed to meet with her partner for the period of 3 months. Even if the head of the family, the male, is married to more than one wives, he is not allowed to enter the room of the wife who has just given birth. Even the girls or the ladies who are still experiencing a menstruation, they are not allowed to enter the room where the mother and the baby are kept. The baby's mother will be allowed to meet with her partner after 3 to 4 months. In our culture, we are having this sickness, the baby sickness called Klopwana. If the baby is experiencing that type of sickness, then the baby must be taken to the traditional healer. For the traditional healer to stop or to heal that sickness, because that sickness is dangerous to the babies. Thank you. That's my presentation.
Thank you very much for lifting a little bit the veil on some of your traditions. It was very interesting. It's over to Mr. Malal to speak to us.
Thank you very much. My name is Ntsiye Malal, coming from Bakgatlhaba Mosetlha tribal area in Moretele Municipality, Northwest Province. I must mention also, Chairperson, that myself and Dikeledi, whatever we put, we are representing the bulk of non-profit organization and cooperatives. This is some of the views they put. I hope, Chairperson, where I start, I'll allow the interpreter to help, but I'll try my lower-level English from Makapan to make sure that I'm here today so that we save time. As you know, this is a deep rural area. Moretele Municipality is 100% rural area with a lot of people not being educated like myself. I'm 48. I only finished my matric in 1980 and I never had any post-training of some sort. So we are experiencing the same challenge where you don't see any further education training centers that they are mushrooming out. So whatever we put here is really not in real sense what we need to put here, but based on their limited skills to make proper presentation, I think at the end it will make sense what we needed to put here. From my colleague, what she mentioned is just a few that she mentioned, the others that we put to the portfolio committee, but to save time, we just took one example that we feel in the rural areas when the bill is passed, that needs to be protected, and that also needs to be disseminated to our young people who are growing up, where we find some of these traditional norms are not yet transferred to our young people. Also from the sector that I represent, there was this humble request for the committee when the work is done to continue engage non-profit organizations and cooperatives where
we are making our own findings that you find some of the activities like this here in the start, but when they finalize the legislation and act, legislation you find cooperatives and NPOs are left in the code. We are making humble request that we want to be part of this all the way. We also encourage the use of libraries in our rural areas for collection and preservation of indigenous knowledge systems. For the mere fact that in our municipality, we have only one library, which is actually saving a lot of people, and feel to be part of this process if that library could help us to document and collect the information about IKS, it would help. And as I introduced myself, I mentioned the issue of lack of skills. As cooperative and NPOs, we say skills development should be a priority for the complete version of this project in terms of collection, dissemination, training, putting on the system, whatever the process that would be done, we would wish to be part of that. When this is an act, we know there would be a lot of also procurement opportunities. The sector that I represent said, I must pass this message to you, the chairperson and the committee, that they would like to emphasize involvement of cooperatives in procurement opportunities, i.e. development and maintenance of the system for IKS. We hope we'll continue to put our inputs together through the guidance of this portfolio committee so that our presentation could be well structured. And we are happy you are here, endorsed by Chief Makaban. Tuesday we were there saying we are coming here. The excitement that is within the Moretele municipality, the NPOs and the cooperative sector, that we should come and make this presentation. First time coming to this area, you can see myself and we are shaking, that is it possible to be here? We never thought it would be possible, but Chairperson, through the engagement, would like to be really in charge of these activities and make sure that we make a positive contribution. And we are saying those who are able to design the proper curriculum on IKS, we need to be engaged so that we take some of our young people in the rural areas to be beneficiaries in terms of skills capacity or bridging in terms of this important component of our life, especially from us in rural areas where you find 60% of our life is dependent on indigenous knowledge system. By virtue of that, Chairperson, I hope I'll get a golden hour to save time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you very much for your cooperation. I think you're making a very important point of the role libraries must play in communities, and that we need to document the indigenous knowledge and keep it for generations so that they can read about it and carry on with the tradition. So thank you very much, very interesting, but please remain with us so there might be further questions at a later stage. Mr. Van Breda, the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council is here. He was with us yesterday, but today we will listen to him. Welcome, and thank you for coming again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the rest of the House, all the leaders, I acknowledge you, I see you. Thank you for being here too. I need to very importantly say who I am first, and then I will lead off to who I represent. My designation within the organization, within the body, is that of leader responsible for administration. I would want to emphasize it again, leader responsible for administration. I'm sitting here representing, in fact, I'm a messenger sitting here, a messenger going to deliver the message coming from the head of this body, the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council, Chief Francisco McKenzie, In fact, the text that I'm going to present to you was prepared with him as the primary speaker. So if I should sound as if I am Chief McKenzie, then that's because the text has been prepared like that. Due to circumstances beyond his control, he couldn't make it. And so therefore I'm standing in. We thought it important not to let this opportunity go by because you are about to go into the provinces and we would like to deliver this message before you go there. So all of that I say as precursors to presenting. Thank you very much again for the opportunity. Thank you very much for the ability to move from that side of the aisle to this side, given my question that I've asked yesterday as to how do I do it. Also, I have a hard copy of all documents that I'm going to refer to for your record. So let me be very formal and hand it over to you. Thank you very much. So on that note, let me proceed. Sida, Sida, Kherat, Swa, Swa. We are beginning. Gangan, Tsi. Thank you, Lord. The Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council, and we have included a document that reflects its strategic framework. It's a document titled Program van Aksie 18 van 11 2016, Program of Action. And as you gathered, I've expressed the title of the document in what we refer to as the language of our survival. In Afrikaans sê die taal van ons oorlewing. So that document we have included as part of this presentation because we would like you to see what is the framework in which we operate and how we view ourselves. Let me just quickly read from that text. It is in Afrikaans. I will do both sides of the language. The vision of the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council in Afrikaans, it is said, die visie van die WK, WK is eer, is om ten volle geïntegreerde Khoisan nasie in die nationale huishouding van die Republiek van Suid-Afrika binne die breër context van die internationale gemeenskap van nasies. In English, we see a completely and fully integrated Khoisan nation within the household of the nation state we call South Africa, within the context of the international community of nations. The vision of the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council is the following. We see, and I will read in Afrikaans, die oorhoofse divisie van die wetgevende raad van die Weskaapse wetgevende raad is die oorhoofse wetgevende liggaam van die om die wetgevende liggaam van die nasie te wees binne die grondwetlike raamwerk van die Republiek van Suid-Afrika van 1996 en sodoende sinvol en ten volle deel te neem aan die wetskeppingsprosesse binne die Republiek van Suid-Afrika raken die belange van die Khoisan nasie. Let me say that with a free translation. The overall mission of the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council is to be the legislative body of the Khoisan nation within the framework, the constitutional framework of the Republic of South Africa. Within the Constitution of 1996, and through that to meaningfully participate within the legislative procedure, processes within the Republic with regards to the interests and also the interest groups of the Khoisan nation. Now for the big however. The big however of our understanding of ourselves is that we have a particular reality that we operate in. And within Afrikaans, we call it a werklikheidsgrondslag. And that werklikheidsgrondslag, let me read it to you. Die WK, WKSR, beweeg vanuit 'n diep bewustheid dat, nummer 1, die belange van die Khoisan nasie in die grondwet van die Republiek van Suid-Afrika van 1996, weggelaat is en dus in die huidige demokratiese bestel geïgnoreer word. Tweedens, die onhoudbare stand van sake net deur middel van 'n nasionale wetgewende instrument gerig nie deur die internasionale wetgewende raamwerke reggestel kan word. Let me say that in English, we operate within the following framework of reality for us, is that the interests and the interest groups within, let me use the collective words, the Kwena and the Kung, that it was left out of a democratic order of 1996. That's the one point. And the second point is that it can only be remedied through the National Assembly or instruments developed there within the context of the international instruments at our disposal. And it's against that background that the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council has the following program of action, 3 points. And for the now, the period that we see ourselves doing all of the above is up until 2019. That's the framework of our current strategic activity. Number one, and I will read in Afrikaans again, om alle Khoisan belangegroepe onder een ideale wetgevende lichaam te konsolideer. Twee, om alle Khoisan belange onder een ideale wetgevende lichaam te konsolideer. Drie, om as communicatieplatform te dien binnen die Khoisan nasie, tussen die nationale, provinciale en plaaslike regeringsstrukture of sfere van die Republiek van Suid-Afrika, met die internationale gemeenskap van nasies, as ook met die internationale en nationale burgersamenleving. Let me say that in English. It is against the background of our strategic vision, mission and our reality statement that we then have the following program of action. Number one is to bring all Khoisan interest groups under one ideally self-expressed legislative body. Number two, to bring together all Khoisan interests under one ideal self-expressed legislative body. And three, to create a platform of communication between ourselves internally, in all our formations, within all our structures, with and between the spheres of government, national, provincial, local, of the Republic, with the international community of nations, as well as the international and national civil society. That's the strategic framework within which we sit here and we operate here. It is in that context, within our intent and also in real terms, as we speak, the council is the most representative body of the Khoisan in the Western Cape province. This much was acknowledged by the person no less than the Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform, Honourable Minister Gugelian Quinty, on 10th May of 2015. There's some history behind that, but I will leave the statement there. If somebody wants to ask a question about that, I can explain what I mean there. The council is the custodian of the history of engagement of the Khoisan since 1980 with the decision makers of our then emerging democracy to include us in a meaningful manner in the new constitutional arrangement of the Republic of South Africa post-apartheid. However, our sincere attempts to engage have thus far been met by constitutional connivance and democratic deceit. And that is the title of our presentation that we are submitting today. Constitutional connivance and democratic deceit. Now, an example, and now I'm speaking as if I'm Chief McKenzie, because it is his example that I'm putting to you. An example of my participation in the groundbreaking conference arranged by IDASA in August of 1995 with the theme National Politics and the Question of Identity, the Case of the Western Cape, has been completely expunged from the historical record as represented by the official publication of that conference titled Now That We Are Free, Coloured Communities in a Democratic South Africa, edited by Wilmer James, Kerry Cullinan and Daria Caligari. The significance of this conference in the evolution of our democracy is underscored by the fact that the keynote speaker of that auspicious event was the first president of our Democratic Republic, President Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela. The limitations of time precludes me from embroidering on this theme through recent examples. However, we want to note that this example of my personal experience, that's now Chief McKenzie, this example of my personal experience in 1995 represents how the legitimate voice of the Khoisan has been systematically and consciously excluded and expunged from the national discourse by the architects of the post-1994 democratic order. The heading I would like to deal with right now is the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council and the Information for the Indigenous Knowledge Systems Bill. That's the heading. And with this submission, the Council formally and officially acknowledges the IKSB in its current form. We further acknowledge and underscore the presentation, in particular of Ms. Aisha Pinto, made on Wednesday, 25th January 2016. Her presentation is an example of an attempt to evaluate the merits of the bill from the Indigenous people themselves as point of entry. In broad strokes, the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council supports her position as reflected in her presentation. However, the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council wishes to add to her evaluation a fundamental point for the attention of the Portfolio Committee on the IKSB. Our addition is that our broad support for her position with regard to the IKSB be read against the background of the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council submission on the TKLB on 30th of November of 2016. Now, for those who don't know what the TKLB is, it is the traditional Khoisan leadership bill that is also in process and that is also going to come before Parliament soon. Now, on the 30th of November, we made a submission and we, as the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council, we would like to emphasize the following point, and I will repeat myself, that our broad support for Ms. Pinto's positions expressed yesterday with regard to the IKSB, that it must be read against the background of the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council submission on the TKLB on the 30th of November of 2016. And we've added a copy of our submission for the committee, and it is part of it. It is an addendum to our presentation. Now, let me, and I'm going to quickly move through that because you have the document, but I would like, just for the sake of the completeness of the presentation, I would like to just touch on the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council and the TKLB. On the 30th of November 2016, the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council rejected the TKLB in its current form. And we base our rejection of the TKLB on the following positions. Number one, that we, the Khoisan, are excluded from the arrangement of Act 108 of 1996, also known as the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. I'm going to say that again. Good morning, Lena. Good to see you. Let me repeat that again, that we, the Khoisan, are excluded from the arrangement of Act 108 of 1996, and it's on that basis that we reject the TKLB, Madam Chair, as we have presented it in November 30th of 2016. The further reason why we rejected the bill in its current form, TKLB, that is, as all legislation emanates from the founding legislation of the Republic, we are of the considered opinion that the TKLB is a manifestation of a haphazard attempt to include the Khoisan into the constitutional arrangement of the country in an improper manner. Furthermore, the silence of the TKLB on the issues of aboriginality, I think we've for the first time heard a new word in our discussion in this committee, the notion of aboriginality, and the First Nation status of the Khoisan people implies that it has been adjudged to be of no consequence by a competent court of law. However, we want to bring it to the attention of the committee, that's now the TKLB committee, and also to this one, that the scrutiny of a competent court of law of the international legal frameworks of the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of the Indigenous People, UNDRIP, and the ILO's Convention 169, as it pertains to the Khoisan, has not yet been initiated nor concluded. Therefore, it is premature for any bill, the TKLB and the IKSB, to be silent on these issues, thus to ignore these fundamental issues. The title of the TKLB suggests we go further to base our arguments on the following, so we go further. The title of the TKLB suggests, but an inclusion of the Khoisan leadership without the acknowledgement of the Khoisan people of which the leaders form a part. Furthermore, the bill talks about the arrangements around the leadership of the Khoisan, but do not, and respectfully we say again, express any word on the acceptance of the existence of the Khoisan people as a fundamental source, thus starting point of its leaders. And so furthermore, the bill confines the role of the invented, cut off from their people, Khoisan leadership, to an advisory role and not a legislative role. This is reminiscent of the advisory councils of the colonial and apartheid eras. The title of the TKLB suggests that the legal arrangements around traditional and Aboriginal communities are to be conflated under one bill. It is our considered opinion that this is a fundamental weakness of the TKLB in its current form, as there are fundamentally different principles governing traditional communities vis-a-vis Aboriginal communities. And then we have just also mentioned the reason why we reject the TKLB in its current form is that the definition of Cape Khoi has no basis in history, but is a product of colonial and apartheid legislation. Therefore, we are of the view that the Aboriginal communities grouped under the notion Cape Khoi, which later became Cape Coloured, was Act 30 of 1950 of the apartheid state, that the groups or that the Aboriginal groups and communities captured with that word, and I would like to mention them individually for your attention, the Kotchokwa, the Horonaikwa, the Horonhanaikwa, the Horonhaikona, the Hesakwa, the Kainokwa, the Korokokwe, that they all be acknowledged as entities in their own right, as were the others. The Griqua, the Korana, the Nama, and the Sun. With regard to the TKLB, it was our prayer then, and it still is, that the Khoisan be included into Act 108 of 1996 in a proper manner, that the Khoisan be afforded their rights as Aboriginal First Nations under the Undraban Convention 169. And that's a mechanism, and I would like to draw the attention of the committee members to this point that I'm going to make right now, in terms of how do we suggest it must be done. That a mechanism similar to the traditional communities under the interim constitution of 1993 that led to Chapter 3 and Chapter 12 of Act 108 of 1996 be enacted for the Aboriginal communities in order to build the institutional coherence of the Khoisan people. That all legislation, that's now a further point, that all legislation, including any future replacement of the TKLB related to the Aboriginal communities, be made distinct from the legislation covering traditional communities. And lastly, it was our prayer with regard to the TKLB that all future legislation concerning the Khoisan, that it is promulgated in alignment with our concerns and prayers contained in that submission. There I want to conclude my reference to our submission to the TKLB. And the heading that I'm dealing with right now is the implications of our submission on the TKLB for the IKSB. The IKSB falls within the ambit of point, the last point that was made.
Mr. Fompertin, you've got about 3 to 4 minutes to conclude, but can I just ask you, just for the record, the TKLB stand for Traditional and Khoisan Leadership
Bill.
Thank you.
Correct. I will complete within 3 minutes. The IKSB falls within the ambit of the point, the last point above, that all future legislation concerning the Khoisan is promulgated in alignment with our concerns and our prayers contained in the submission, where the word future can also be understood as further, meaning any further legislation. The IKSB engages the knowledge we go further in terms of what the implications for the TKLB and for the IKSB. Our second point is that the IKSB engages the knowledge of a people without acknowledging the people from whence the knowledge comes. The IKSB engages knowledge practitioners without acknowledging the wider social network of culture within which those knowledge workers draw their locus standi. Four, the IKSB engages knowledge practitioners and communities as co-contractors of economic beneficiation without acknowledging the overarching political and governance structures within which these practices and economic activities are located. Therefore, fundamentally, the IKSB, like the TKLB, is a manifestation of a haphazard attempt to include the Khoisan into the legal arrangement of the Republic in an improper manner. However, this time around, with the IKSB, this haphazard attempt has sinister implications. Because the IKSB represents the smoking gun of the complicity of the 1994 democratic order in the ongoing harvesting of economic value from the Aboriginal citizens of the Republic following in the footsteps of its colonial and apartheid precursors. Please note, and now I'm concluding, please note, and I would like to say as background, I want to mention the Bill of Rights and the explicitly expressed democratic, non-racial, non-sexist, liberal economic intent of the post-1994 state. Against that background, please note that through the IKSB are legitimate expectations of being equal beneficiaries of the fruits of the collective social goods is again trampled underfoot, and our existence is again clothed in the haze of being talked about but not being formally acknowledged as Aboriginal citizens of the Republic. Because, and in inverted commas I say, because the progressive constitution makers of 1990 to 1996 excluded the Aboriginal Khoisan from Act 108 of 1996, commonly known as the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. Our prayer with regard to the IKSB is but one point, that the IKSB be read against the background of the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council submission on the TKLB on 30 November of 2016. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, our fellow committee members and participants to the public hearing, thank you for the opportunity to make the submission on behalf of the ignored and the denied Khoisan people standing at the gates of our democratic parliament. I thank you for this opportunity to make a contribution to the ongoing deepening and broadening of our hard fought for democracy. Atua Tabakamski. For those who don't know, I just said is that our struggle continues. Thus ended the message of Chief Mackenzie. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fambroda, for your presentation. You will see on the program that there is not time, you know, to engage in questions, but we are slightly ahead of time, and the acting chairperson has graced us now with her attendance, but with her permission, we have done four presentations, and I'm going to allow you now for about 10 to 15 minutes to ask questions, and then I'll hand over to her, and then we'll start off with Prof. Lungi Kuduka after that, under her chairmanship. Acting Chair, we've also decided that the break is too long, and that we will have a shorter break so that there will also be time to engage with the other presenters. So yes, members, over to you for questions. Paulson, you can start.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, my question is to Dr. Rees, and Dr. Rees said that the bill is a thinly veiled attempt to further entrench the pillaging of Indigenous knowledge or something to that effect, but same context. So I want to know from Dr. Rees whether the problem lies with the actual bill, or if it is, as another presenter stated yesterday, that the problem lies with the Intellectual Property Act that would endanger the ownership of this knowledge. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Paulson. Anybody else? We're going to take all the questions and then you can reply. Honourable Member.
Yeah, Chairperson, I don't really have a question. I have just got a comment. I would like to say thank you for this contribution, and I am sure we will definitely take note, like with all the others, and interrogate it. Thanks.
Acting Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and my apologies for being late. And thank you for the presentation. I just want to find out about this other bill that you're talking about as to where is it? Your bill, the TK something.
TKLB?
TKLB.
Yes, our presentation, I've handed over a package that covers all the documents I refer to. And the TKLB, our presentation is included in that.
I want to find out the bill. Is it with the Western Cape? Is it with the COFTA? Is it
It's through COFTA, and the chair there is Mr. Dakane. He is the portfolio chair. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Just from my side, a few questions. First to Mr. Rees. If traditional healers do not ask any fees, how do they survive? In terms of, you know, just how do they just survive through the day if they is the system for free? I just want to know about that. And then also to Mr. Sandile Mashiki, in general, are you in support of the IKS bill? If you can just reply to that for me. And then, yeah, that's it. Over to the presenters, will you please, Mr. Paulson?
Sorry, can we ask all our questions?
Let's do this round and then I'll give you another. Shall we start with you, Mr. Rees?
Sure. The first question about the veiled attempt, I think if we look at the context of how bioprospecting has occurred in South Africa over the last 30, 40 years, academia has been jealously guarding traditional medicine research that they've basically harvested in rural communities for those decades. In many cases, it was done in a very unethical manner, tantamount to when the colonialists arrived in Africa and took away parcels of land from people and their cattle for cheap beads and broken mirrors. And what has happened is these vast databases that are held by institutions have been jealously guarded up until recently. And those databases have been used to pull apart, pick apart, and look for molecules for bioprospecting. Now, bioprospecting is prevalent and is very high on the agenda in this country. And it has been driven principally by foreign interest groups and academia who obviously want to be a part of the R&D research and development side of it. If you look at the South African launches, the bioeconomic strategy document, which the DST has published and is on their website in the public domain, you can see the companies, the drug companies, that are behind this and supporting this. What is going to happen, what we believe, is once this bill is promulgated, if you look at Section 33, which is, I've been speaking to some of the members in DST yesterday, and I have a slightly different understanding maybe to what's going on, but as the bill stands, Section 33 gives historical use, or people with historical claims on traditional medicine use, or their novel use of plants, only 12 months to make claims to the NICSA, the National IKS office. And after that 12 months would prescribe, what would happen to those databases? How will that knowledge then be protected? Because what would happen, it would leave a gap for the state, number one, through its NICSA and its vested interest in accruing its own royalties out of this, and academia,
to basically sell a lot of this information off to the highest bidders. And that is the problem. In many cases, these databases, if you look at them, they have contributions to unknown sources. A lot of healers and groups have died and passed on, or there wasn't correct entries made, or during apartheid, to be honest, the researchers didn't care about giving acknowledgement to African communities. Now that knowledge, once it's embedded into this IKS system, how are those communities going to be traced back? And how exactly are those benefits going to be shared? The only sharing that's going to happen in this case is going to be between Nixo and the companies that are going to take the lion's share of profits at the end of the day. And that is the thinly veiled thing that I'm talking about. Thank you.
Can we have somebody else? Mr. Rees, just on my question, is traditional heathens asking a fee for their service?
Traditional healers never asked fees because there was no such thing as money. Okay, it was a barter and trade system. Many of the traditional healers don't charge prescribed fees; they work on a donation basis. Some traditional healers I know in certain communities that I've met, they take small amounts of donations from the community, and then when people get sick, they don't have to pay at that time. It's kind of an energy exchange, let's put it that way. It's not, but there are healers that are selling commercial products, commercializing traditional medicines, and that kind of becomes very problematic in terms of the cultural milieu of traditional medicine, that these sacred medicines are made available to the masses without proper care and proper management by the healers who understand and know those medicines best.
Okay, thank you very much. Can we have Siki?
Thank you, Chairman. According to my experience and regarding this bill, I've realized that it is full of holes, especially when it comes to intellectual property pertaining to, that is, the games, indigenous games. Officials, that is, at local, provincial, and at times national bodies that deal with these games, they don't know as to what is supposed to be done. For example, when I own intellectual property, let's say, for example, the design to play a certain particular game, they sort of say, Sandile, you don't have the authority to own that game. And it will be an argument like, no, I don't own that game. The authority that owns that game is probably the Department of Arts and Culture or the National Arts Body. But I do have the right to own the IP of the design of to play that game. And they will sort of, now it will be that, no, we won't give you the authority to. So really, there are so many things. I do have my own questions that I wanted to ask the body regarding some of the things. It really needs to be amended here and there.
Mr. Siki, can I ask you that you put that in writing? We're not going to have time for this interaction, but do put it, please, in writing, all your concerns in terms of the IKS bill and also with regard to your proposals towards amendments, and that will be absolutely discussed here and it will be sent to the department when we engage with them.
Thank you.
Mr. Paulson, a last bite to you and then I want to conclude.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is to Mr. Van Bredaar. He spoke about the Western Cape Khoisan Council. Now, is this a statutory body? How was it set up? Who do you represent? There's quite a number of groups here, and it seems as if you as if there's no unity amongst people falling under a Khoisan umbrella, that they're all pulling in different directions. So I'd just like to get a sense as to how big the Khoisan community is, and how much of that Khoisan community the Western Cape Khoisan Council actually represents. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity to give an answer to that very sensitive issue. Let me start out by saying that the perception that there are various voices not necessarily agreeing with one another, not necessarily speaking to one another, that is pretty true. So let me not say that it is anything else, but it is true, meaning that the level of coherence within the leadership or within the organization or the formations is indeed not as high as it should be. Agreed. However, I want to give a historical angle to give you an answer, and I want to give you a contemporary. The National Khoisan Council has been at TKLB point that 30th of November. It has been, I can almost say, shot down in argument by many a presenter. So the last body that represented some level of coherence, there's a transition between that into what it is that we want to move towards. So the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council, in terms of its history, coming into being in May of 2015, it had the human resources of the National Khoisan Council. It had it present at that point when the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council came into being. So the 12 formations were present, and all other entities at that point. So there is indeed a line of carrying a flame that may well be flickering right now in the wind, but it is one that is growing very, very stronger by the day. So that's the historical claim in terms of representing that voice of engagement. Having acknowledged that it is indeed a difficult conversation in itself. However, between the 30th of November to date, a whole range of confluence is happening as we speak. Right now, as we speak, there is even a call for a national consultative conference that is in embryo form, and I'm talking about a concept note that is existing.
Mr. Van Bredaar,
so
you know, we need to stick to the bill. So if you can be very concise,
sure.
With regard to you, I need to conclude this.
I hear you, Chair, and I apologize for being slightly longer in terms of my explanation, but in terms of the question, it could not get a one-sentence answer because it is indeed complex. So, short, if I could just conclude by saying that there is a high level of engagement right now as we speak to bring that internal coherence. And I'm comfortable that the Western Cape Legislative Khoisan Council, in terms of its strategic documentation and in terms of its engagement, is carrying that flame, and we are protecting it pretty, pretty close to our chest.
Mr. Olsen.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Mr. Van Bredaar, for your response. I think, Chairperson, for the benefit of the committee, we could actually get a more comprehensive response in writing. It would be good having some background going forward.
I agree with that. I think it's important. And also, if you have any, are you an NGO, do you have support from national or provincial governments, that will also be interesting. Thank you very much. Thank you for allowing me to chair. And it's over to the acting chairperson to take us to the second round.
Thank you very much, Honorable Koronov, for holding the fort, and good morning, Honorable members and everybody. Thank you for those who have already presented. So we're going to take another four presenters, as it was done this morning. So we'll have Professor Lumkuduga and Mrs. Khosani or Rosa. Okay, we'll take that. And yeah, you can begin now. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and for giving us the opportunity to make this presentation, which is very dear to our hearts. And thank you, Shanaz, for making it possible for us to come to Parliament in Cape Town. First time in Parliament in Cape Town, so that feels good to be here. Thank you very much for that. And the subject matter that we are presenting on is very dear to us, and I've been working on this for quite some time. I started to work on IKS whilst I was a professor at Michigan State University in the US, and I was invited to be a chair of IKS at WSU for the past 6 years. So this is what I've been doing. As it says on the PowerPoint, I'm a former IKS researcher at Walter Sisulu University, and currently I'm retired right now, but I have not stopped. I'm continuing to work on IKS at, in a village as a founder and chairperson of Ezigo Research Community Center at Tsingo local municipality, Eastern Cape Province. And then Ms. Rosani is currently a graduate student, a postgraduate student, doing work or her thesis for PhD on IKS at Walter Sisulu University. As I begin, or we begin rather, giving the background and introduction to our submission and the importance of this submission, I am going to be quoting Professor Yona Seleti, who wrote an introduction or prologue in this anthology, which was published in 2016, and whose title is Locating African Voices and Worldviews Within the Academy. This is our volume one, and we're planning to be working on volume two. He said, it has been more than 10 years to date since the adoption of the IKS policy by the South African cabinet. Since then, little uptake by universities has been done on a voluntary basis. It should be obvious that universities have not yet identified the value of IKS to their enterprise, or they are so implicated in the colonial business of intellectual dependency on Western forms of knowledge that they are content with playing a second fiddle role of pursuing a knowledge agenda that is based on the Western experience. Close quotes. So we're basing our submission on this, and mainly the lack of commitment by schools in general, and specifically by universities, to integrating IKS within the curriculum. So the reasoning behind why is it important to do this? Why is it significant that IKS be integrated within the curriculum at different levels? It is rooted in African worldviews, ancestral wisdoms and teaching cultures and languages. And actually this anthology, it lays out, it outlines how this is done. How do we know, how do Africans know what they know? It is not book knowledge, It is not written anywhere, but it is something that is, it is transmitted from generation to generation. And then we know, we get to know. We know about the weather, we know about when it is going to rain, we know about seasons, we know about everything. And most of these people have not been to school to learn about astrology and things like those. It is rooted in principles that privilege the interrelationships among the spiritual, the natural, and the self. We know that the self does not stand on its own, but the self is interrelated with the spiritual and the natural. It is rooted in the sacredness of place and space. Even this space, the parliament itself, the classroom, the hall, every space is sacred. There's something important about it. So it needs to be respected. So we teach children from the beginning of life to respect themselves and respect the space where they are. It's rooted in fluidity of knowledge exchange between past, present, and future, on honoring of language and orality as important means of knowledge transmission, because that is how, according to indigenous people, knowledge is transmitted. Not that we undermine the written word, that too is important, but orality is very, very important. These principles reflect the understanding that indigenous people hold an extensive wealth of knowledge, even if this knowledge has not always been recognized in the context of Western-based education. And that is the reason, amongst other things, for this submission. Educators are now growing in their understanding that IK represents a highly effective approach to education to support deep learning, inclusivity, and response to learners and learning styles, languages, and cultures which represent their background. Because the most unfortunate thing is that our education undermines and denigrates the background of where students come from, the learning styles that were different from Western people and African people. So that has to be, we need to pay attention to that. So in the form inclusion, in the classroom it serves to honor that indigenous peoples have a robust and deep knowledge base that has been previously either ignored or denigrated. It makes room in our schools for African learners to see elements of who they are reflected around them, helps other learners develop an understanding to bridge some of the divide. So it is not only about indigenous children or indigenous learners, but it is about others, the non-indigenous, who have to learn from the beginning of life that there are other ways of knowing besides their way of knowing. Therefore, integrating indigenous perspectives of teaching and learning can be immensely valued in creating a more responsive education system for all students at all levels. And as I said, it is not only about indigenous learners, but it is about all learners. I'm not going to go over this because I know I'm speaking to the choir. So there's no need for me to go over what it is. We sort of understand, I think what is important is going to be why. Why are we interested in indigenous knowledge? The national education system at a global policy level are seen as a critical building block in fostering positive attitudes about human rights, equitable resource management, and development, and the preservation of the Earth's diversity. So it is very, very important. Yes, it is important in education, but also in other spheres, particularly preservation of the Earth's diversity. And the main important thing has to do right now, we are confronted with climate change, global warming, and the risks that are entailed in that. How do we pull in, how do we draw from IKS? In the past and currently, Western-based education has been criticized for dismissing and attempting to supplant IK. Those involved in Western science and technology are beginning to recognize the value of IK in terms of gaining an insight into managing ecological sustainability and resource biodiversity, particularly in line of the climate change. Relation of IK to other educational theory. Constructivism supports the belief that there is not one objective reality to which all learners aspire to know, and instead the learner makes sense of the world based on his or her experiences, while the system of education tends to value Western-based knowledge over others. The truth is that there is value found in knowledge systems of indigenous cultures. And the sad thing is, this knowledge is out there. This knowledge is embraced, but the sad thing is that there is no implementation. There's no practice. It seems like no one cares. As I said, I was at WSU for almost 6 years. It is all lip service. It is all, oh, we appreciate your presence. It is wonderful we have you. And the story ends there. So that, I guess, the part of this submission, the question becomes, how do we get into maybe starting with lower levels, early childhood education, and then so that children grow up knowing that there's not only one way of knowing, learning, teaching, understanding the world, but there are multiple ways of doing that. I guess the question really that we have, and hopefully we can get some answers from the audience here. Therefore, cultural knowledge held by the learner, even when it may seem to come into conflict with concepts being taught, needs to be recognized and can, in many cases, be used to help learners understand concepts stemming from other cultural worldviews. And the most important thing is, and as I said, I was in the U.S. for teaching at a university for almost 25 years or so, so that I came into contact with different cultures, I mean different cultures, in the real sense of the word. So that it is very, very important when a student, a learner comes from one perspective, then other students, they come in from their perspectives. Then there is that synergy. We bring these different perspectives together, and then it makes sense to both students or learners. Implications for classroom and school. The willingness of educators, it has to be educators first, to see themselves as learners and seek to develop their own understanding first. So the main important thing here is the professor, it is the teacher in the classroom. How does the teacher see himself or herself? How can the teacher be helped? And I think it is important because all our backgrounds, including teachers in at different levels, deeply steeped, our backgrounds are deeply steeped in Western ways of knowing. How do we uproot? How do we get teachers to think from a different perspective or from their own perspective and then transfer that understanding? Understanding that education systems are not value-free. We tend to say that, oh, education is value-free. It's all about teaching. It is just about teaching. We should not be worried about where children come from and the question of let's promote IK or integrate IK, because all learning is good and we need to encourage or promote English, because without English our children would not do well in the world. That is good, but not good enough. Because in terms of language, if we begin children with their own language, culture and everything, then they can add on in terms of language. They can learn French, they can learn German, they can learn any other language and add on, as long as they have a basis and understand where they are. And this is also about identity. Learners, young learners, should begin knowing their names. Our names, for instance, we lost that. The normal Lungelo thing is very, very new. I've been Ivy, Ivy, Ivy all along. And the question becomes, how do you become an Ivy in a village, very dry village, which does not even have the green, beautiful Ivy plant? So those are the conflicts that we've been dealing with. Then when I came home after the U.S., then I decided I got rid of the Ivy thing, and then I feel good about my name. And when I see it in Parliament, Nomalungelo Potuka, makes me feel great. ensuring meaningful inclusion of indigenous content and recognizing that indigenous knowledge is connected to specific contexts appropriate for another community. How am I doing in terms of time? Oh, so let me go to the end. I just want to make these concluding remarks. The IKS bill that we're not proposing the IKS, but the submission provides a sui generis protection of the IKS bill, of course, of IK, including the registration of IK. Therefore, this submission has highlighted a number of important aspects for those who wish to raise awareness of IK in education and in other significant aspects of life. A careful consideration of these issues will assist in the broader context of enhancing the contribution of IKS to sustainable development for human development, both locally and globally. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, Prof, for the presentation. We're happy that you had a global experience that you also bring in. So your presentation makes that distinction, and you can hear that from your presentation or your submission, there's more emphasis on education, not just on the bill itself, but on indigenous knowledge generally, or should be part of the curriculum from primary up. Thank you very much. Can we have now Dr. Masipa? Not yet. Mr. Lennox Olivier?
Hi, I'm Lennox Olivier. I'm the co-director of the Cape Bush Doctors, one of the founder members. However, in my emails, I have stipulated that the chairperson will be here to do the presentation today, but somehow I think in the admin, my name got placed there. Although I'm here, I would like to hand over to Brian Damonso, who is the chairperson, and I think the more appropriate person to do this presentation today. Thank you.
Brian.
Hi.
You have to come this way. Sorry. Do you need the slide presentation today? Do you need the slide?
Yeah, it can be put on this.
Do you have a still?
No, I thought that I've handed in the presentation that it would also be prepared, but if not,
no,
it's not a problem.
It only has to do, if you
okay.
Must bring a stick.
No problem there. Greetings. Kaitas. Mura. Kebrala Kwailo, Kebrala Hamla. Kebrala Dumse. Kebrala Selassie is the first. I greet you all in the name of our Imperial Majesty, and in the name of our ancestors, who has given me the opportunity to be alive today to carry the word which they want me to speak to you. Through my bloodline, coming from the Kai Korana, being amongst the healers, Sir Chief Doman, a bloodline family, last well-known healer be my grandmother, her passing on the ancestral roots to me, Cora, I greet you all today. I am also the chairperson of the Cape Bush Doctors, an organization which represent all indigenous knowledge holders that specialize in the indigenous knowledge of the plant kingdom in the Cape. Due to the nature of our organization, our members are mostly concerned with the recognition of their ownership of the indigenous knowledge, specifically from our Khoi and Bushman oral traditions, regarding the use of our South African indigenous medicinal plants and all their forms of traditional healing. Herewith follows the short list of comments and concerns and questions that I would raise on behalf of my members, the Cape Bush Doctors, and NPO representing Khoi and Bushman traditional healers, as to the proposed IKS bill. Number one, there is a great reason of concern regarding the definition proposed in the bill of an indigenous community. This definition clearly can easily be excluded, especially small and currently still unrecognized groups, even organizations and especially individuals. It is very unclear what it meant in the definition by recognized by other groups as a distinct collective. Who are these other groups referring to in this bill? And how can we guarantee our recognition for our healer members who are individuals that live even today in larger communities who do not even identify themselves as to any other distinguished group? Our members often stand alone within their so-called colored or black communities. They more than often stand alone in a large area of people as lone custodians of their indigenous Khoi and Bushman heritage. Alone amidst a majority of what has become normalized as westernized communities. These communities of indigenous peoples who have lost mostly touch with the traditions of South African heritage due to the hundreds of years of colonial and apartheid oppression. Some of our members also belong to a range of different indigenous communities and localized groups and organizations, and they are spread all over South Africa. What binds them together are that they shared medical practices and knowledge, but most of all, their common link to the recognition of the indigenous Khoi and Bushman roots of their knowledge. With this definition proposed for the bill, formally recognized by our organization and all its members as an indigenous community per se. Secondly, the bill proposed to facilitate the record and help market via productive product development schemes our members, individuals and collective indigenous knowledge. However, it fails to even mention the fact that all our members in the Western and in the Northern Cape are still currently forced by law to practice their own traditions and medical practices illegally. No medicinal plant harvesting permits has ever been issued thus far, and no certification has been granted to any of our members. Despite even our ongoing participation in even other programs provided by government to facilitate these processes. Government has failed so far to provide our members with the necessary recognition as legitimate healers or licenses and permits to access and even harvest our traditional medicinal plants, or to even trade openly and legally within our own communities. How can we agree to share and trust our knowledge with the Department of Science and Technology? If up to now, even after 22 years after the end of apartheid, we only see the ongoing of apartheid oppression and practices and cultural traditions and beliefs that have not been recognized by the Department of Health even, or even the Department of Environmental Affairs. Thirdly, how can the bill propose for one department to record and commercialize our members' indigenous knowledge if our indigenous practices are not even legal in other departments? Not even legalized yet for our members to practice freely in their own communities without fear of prosecution or even imprisonment by the same government. Today I was coming in from Stellenbosch and I saw guys, bush doctors, running over the N1 with sacks of medicine which they need to serve their community, but as soon as they walk into a police, they go into jail. Recording is like entrapment to us. It is to confuse and make laws in other departments. What is it that the IKS can do to make sure that we are not being prosecuted? To make sure that we don't go to jail like we still are going to jail daily? Number four, our healer members have participated in and been instrumental in the formulation and the development of Act 22 of 2007. How can we entrust that this bill will recognize that historical effort and the ongoing participation of our members over the last 10 years? Number five, how do we do not believe that the Department of Science and Technology is the correct platform to record, protect and manage our indigenous knowledge? From all our previous engagement with scientific researchers, and we have participated with scientists a lot in the past, we have had endless struggles in terms of inequality, intellectual abuse, and always certain levels of misinformation resulting in gross negligence of the knowledge providers. And you must please remember that outside in our communities, it has been always and will always be seen that science and technology are against spirit, and healers are all about spirit. And that we have a government department that is already working with traditional affairs. And like all African traditions, healers and leaders cannot be divided. Then you don't have an African tradition. Then you're denying your African ancestral roots. We find it difficult to accept that this department, as a collective to whom we should entrust all our sacred knowledge for safekeeping, since we are aware of the commercial interests underlying all science and technological development and all instruments. We know science and technology is all about making money, while healing is all about serving people. We are currently very suspicious of entrusting even any governmental department with our indigenous knowledge. And we propose that government rather fund our own and support our own organizations and infrastructures, which we have painstakingly set up over the years to record, safeguard, and manage our own members' indigenous knowledge and benefit sharing. We are very competent to do this and have been doing this for the last 5 years with the Department of Environmental Affairs under the Bioprospecting and Benefit Sharing Forum. Despite any support from any government, what we need is financial support from government even to continue with these tasks. Is this bill even designed to support our organization in our quest to preserve our members' knowledge, or is it just intended to become the sole custodian of all traditional knowledge? And does that also mean that if a person that does not want to record his knowledge with the IKS, then not be seen as a knowledge holder? Will the people that does not want to recognize or have the knowledge recorded still be IKS holders under the law? The way the bill is set out, it raises very much concerns that it will only divide and create conflict amongst the different groups representing IKS holders. We would like to see it should facilitate the recognition of all IKS holders regardless of whether individual groups are willing to register and even share their knowledge with government. It only creates a new form of an insider and an outsider amongst our indigenous communities, where the government's task is actually
supposed to break down such divisions. I thank you for this opportunity to submit these comments and questions regarding the proposed bill, and I am looking forward to a very speedy response. Kai Gangans, Hanawa Gangans. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Not Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Tamonsa. The next presenter will be Chief Sedas, Shadra Kleinschmidt, House of Shamlila. Are they here? They're not here. Is Chief Melvin Aronson?
Says, Malwani, Khemore, and good morning. I would like to thank you for the opportunity on behalf of the Kaikorana people, our district chieftaincies, our elders from the Southern Cape to Witzenberg, to Cape Winelands, to the Cape Town Metro, to the Karoo, and the West Coast. I would like to take the opportunity to remind us what IP means to the Khoi and San people. From a pre-colonial perspective, before the arrival of Mr. Van Riebeeck and company, we had a particular order on which our existence was governed in South Africa. Well, us, the Khoi and San, and our Nguni cousins have a lot in common in that respect, and that is that our entire existence is based on principles. Principles that you can today find since the colonial period and since apartheid. Today what we have is only the memories and the graves. We received a list from Iziko Museums on 120 human remains that is 120 years old that was laying in cardboard boxes in museum cells, in local and international museums. So it's a very sore point for us as Kurana, and I believe our Busman and Nguni brothers as well, because the only time this country recognizes us and our IP is when we're dead. In the same way, our people who died on the SS Mendi, our people who died in LLM in Tobruk, our people who died in every conflict that we did not ask for in this country. My great-grandfather is Hendrik Kaffer Kurana of the Frontier State. And his great-great-grandfather is Klaas Lukas Kurana of the Frontier States. And that is the old Cape Colony there to fight the British on the one hand and the Boer militia on the other hand. And the reason for that was the IP. Because what happened is, long before the arrival of penicillin and all these Western medicines, it was a commonly known fact that what resonated among the Khoi people in terms of medicine and in practices was inseparable from the land. Before I go there, I just want to give you a rundown of what indigenous knowledge means to chieftaincies and what a chieftaincy is. A chieftaincy is a successional practice of governance and a transfer of memory and customs and knowledge from one generation to the next. The purpose of that is to ensure consistency and continuity in civil obedience, peace, stability, trade, and progress. That was the norm until the military occupation of the colonial period and apartheid government disrupted us to the point where if you look at the bones Ezekiel is giving us back today, to make sure they procure the IP, they took our chiefs and buried them in foreign countries so that our clans could not pay homage to the burial grounds where they were murdered or ambushed. So the other method of appropriation was simply, they simply took them and made them slaves. So you had people being born for the explicit purpose to sustain the customary transfer of memory on a farm. So you have one Khoi family having their name changed, working on a farm for three generations, for 100 years, just to procure the IP, because in some rural districts that the IP was shared among district elders and chieftaincies to the point where it didn't matter where the person was. So coming back to IP, today we know how a child is prepared for his duties and responsibilities in a Kurana Dorop ceremony, where the child is taught from his ancestral practices as to what is the duty of a child, the respect for his parents, the respect for the community, the respect for the environment, where a child is taught that when men walk in the field, they don't walk next to each other, so that they do not leave an unwanted footprint. The importance and significance of educating a child from his ancestry and community perspective is so crucial. In IP, it is inseparable from the Khoi and their land. Well, we had a problem. We were separated from our land and separated from our practices. My mother was born on the Methodist mission station. To consolidate the takeover and appropriation, the mission stations came and said, look, your customs and practices are paganism. It is an abomination. It is an abomination against the word of God, which is the Bible. Your medicines that you use, you are a pack of quacks, to put it nicely, and you are in prison. What essentially happened is they outlawed our culture but secured our IP, because the missionaries used the chieftaincies to specifically cultivate on church grounds, medicine gardens, herbal gardens, etc. That was traded. So it was expropriation by a different means once again. Coming back to the question of customs, after a child has been prepared for his role in society and his role in environment, a child is not idealized. A child is prepared for responsibility in our culture, as it is in Nguni culture. A child is prepared to make a meaningful contribution to society in our customs and memories. What the now ceremony entails to us, it is the appreciation and celebration of the transfer and consistency of that memory. When we look at succession and education, if we have to look at the previous speaker, I have to say to her, where we are today in the Western Cape is that among ourselves we have consulted with the other brothers who we know were there for the last 100 years with us, which is the Ibikwa San Busmans, the Nguni chieftaincies of the Kozas. So we got together with them and said, brothers, are we facing a new form of colony? This is the government we fought for. Shall we go and explain to them that the ICARES Bill, in particular NICSA, represents a new form of colonialism if it goes through in their current form? Because where we are, we still have proof the 1913 Native Land Act fortunately left us with some good things. That the first titles were registered where we were, which means there's proximity proof of consistency that we were there after 1900. The Methodist mission station and the other mission stations fortunately helped us in that regard too. So we can prove proof of proximity, and we still have those title deeds in our, even though most have been taken by other legislation. But what it confirms particular vegetation associated with particular people, associated with particular periods. So it is in that consistency we said it's not government's responsibility to organize us, because government needs simply to engage and listen and say, but this is a process of submission, adjudication, to say what is workable from a policy perspective. That is why I say, as much as I say to government, I also say to the groupings, you need to consolidate what you have in common, because that is what the Kurana and the Bikwa Busmans and the Ngunis is doing in the Western Cape. We're coming up with a commonality by saying, you've been here, we've been here for more than 100 years. This is our traditional medicine. This is our traditional practices. So from that perspective, we have a consolidated approach to say, in terms of Nixa, there's too many unanswered questions. In our community, like Swellendam, you have Slangerivier on the outside. The healer in Slangerivier does not belong to any particular body, but he plays a pivotal role, not just in medical, in traditional medicine practices, but in sustaining memory as well, and succession of a culture that is far older than the world that you know. What I'm saying is, our plight is inseparable, because the traditional healers have been part of our inventory of memory for thousands of years. If you look at the ancient fish traps that is found commonly on our west coast, all the way up to the north, you will find it is as old as the Maya, the Incas, in the Maori fish traps, dating back thousands of years. The ability, the scientific ability, has been inherent to Khoi and Nguni clans for thousands of years. We cannot have law constantly saying, yes, we know you're there, yes, it could be yours, but you're not competent to manage it. We need the IKS proposal to understand, we need to factor in public-private partnerships. We cannot fight for a democracy that says the people shall govern, but conveniently, we are never either fit or competent to help govern. The one thing I respect about the Claudi Mutsaheng situation, he had a valid point. To say, are we only capable of doing a job when we qualify? Under normal, reasonable norms, you would have to agree. But this is South Africa. It is not the United States. It is not a first world country. It is a developing country, painfully suffering from a very apocalyptic past. I will say, unashamedly say, we have been fighting bitterly since the formation of the ANC by the great chiefs Albert Luthuli and Dube, for the fundamental reason that it has a peculiar identity, in the sense that today this government has an unthinkable task of cleaning up 480 years of an apocalypse. You can replace the money, but you cannot replace the wounds. 480 years, an entire population displaced, an entire country displaced of their land. So what I'm saying is, this is the point where we need to say to this government, you need to listen to us, Madam Chair. I want you to understand that we will be making a very detailed technical submission. In its current form, the Kai Kurana opposes this bill in principle, because it is destroying the essential elements of our culture, which is our traditional healers. We take deep offense that our healers have to be called bush doctors. Well, the bush used to belong to us. So the thing is this, our question is, why do they have to be in the bush? Whenever the first pharmacists, when land needed to be registered, they instituted the Surveyor General's Act, the Deeds Office Act. That is to make sure there's consistency and equity in managing land and matters like that. So why is it that we have to prove that we are entitled to a public-private partnership in terms of provincial structures that are made up of natural healers, traditional practitioners, traditional authorities, and government? Why must it exclusively be government? Why must it exclusively be academics? Those are the fundamental concerns that we have as Kai Kurana. In closing, I would like to say this to you. We can still save what we can save in the next 10 years. After 10 years, who knows what is left to be saved? Who knows who will still matter? We are living in a society today where people just survive and do what they have to survive. We need to preserve our indigenous knowledge. We need legislation, but legislation must be. We can't legislate the way we legislated 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we still saw whites as the enemy and the perpetrators of our misery. Today, we ourselves are the perpetrators of our misery. So we should take the warrant of indictment that we historically had against white people and throw it in a bin somewhere, because if I have to make an example, more people are dying on the Cape Flats today in gang-related violence than in the entire period of the liberation struggle in the Western Cape. My point is, today we have an opportunity more than we have an indictment. We have a great opportunity. That is why we said, we don't have money. Our Nguni brothers don't have money. But we have a collective memory. Between that collective memory, in terms of advocating what the speakers before me have advocated, we prove the enormous value that there is. We will even show you instances where white Afrikaner people make enormous contributions to indigenous knowledge. Enormous, especially in most rural areas of the Western Cape. Our concluding point is, as Kai Kurana, IP is not exclusive, but the regulations must be partnership friendly. We cannot have orthodox methods of government in place when it comes to, because memory is precious, it belongs to a family, the practices of that family is precious. We cannot be played off to compete for resources. If we have a superstructure in the north, we have the NKC, it couldn't function for 20 years. It didn't have a dime as a budget. If in the previous speaker, Mrs. Pinto yesterday, if you take her point, you have to take the moral essence of what she is saying. You are creating white elephants that you yourselves cannot control. How do you want us to worship and obey them? We want to obey the laws, but we need the laws to be people-friendly, especially Aboriginal and Nguni people-friendly, because this knowledge mostly originates from us. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Chief Arinsa. Thank you. We will have a question to the presenters, and then we will take, after that, we'll take Professor Owen Dean and look at whoever has arrived, if they have not, we'll have to reschedule them. Honourable members, questions to the presenters? No questions?
Can I ask? You know, we, and especially to the professor, I want to. Prof Kuduku, I'm here. And maybe to all the other presenters, what I want to ask is, are you 50% in support of the IKS bill or not? Is there some support from your communities for the bill? And what do you want more out of the bill if you're not happy? Want more consultation? Do you, because in the end we are the legislators, and in the end we must legislate. And when you are making laws, you know, unfortunately you can never please everybody. That is simply impossible. But what my question is the idea bigger than the concerns? Are we on the right track with regard to the IKS bill?
Madam Chair, I can respond.
Thank you very much. Please note the questions.
Yeah.
Because I want to also ask some. I did comment on the submission by Professor Kuduga. The aspect that indigenous knowledge is not codified, but transferred from generation to generation. I think it is something that is very important that we are looking at. And but your proposals of the inclusion in the curriculum will form part of some codification of that. To Mr. Damonse, I just wanted to find out if there is coordination between your organization and others in the Western Cape, like those that were presented by Chief McKenzie. If you're working in silos or there is coordination, because you all, I mean, it also goes to you for it's for the same cause. It also goes to Chief Arons, that question. And yes, Chief, we would like to have a submission, if you could give us a written submission on the issues that you raise and the proposals that you'd want to see in the bills. But coming back to Mr. Damonse, I see in your presentation you say that you are skeptical in trusting the government. But then, if so, why are you here? Why are you here? If you're skeptical in trusting the government, but also you raise an issue of not trusting this one department to record and commercialize the indigenous knowledge, and also you're very aware of the commercial interest underlying all scientific and technological development and investment. So what is your proposal? Yeah, then you say that you've been doing this for 5 years, but you are currently very suspicious of trusting any governmental department with indigenous knowledge. But on the other hand, you propose that government must rather fund and support your own organizational infrastructure. I think there is contradiction. You're not recognizing the very government that you want it to fund you. The issue of no medicinal plant harvesting permits have been issued so far, and no certification has been granted to any of your members despite ongoing participation in all the programs provided by the government to facilitate these processes. The other contradiction I see, you do participate in government programs, but you don't recognize it. And I wanted to find out, with this certification, did you apply for them? And because you said there's no recognition and there's no certification that is being granted to your members. But on the other hand, of just across in the issue of that the coefficients are not and are not recognized. There was an email that was sent to me in December saying that the Khoisan Nation Self-Defense Unit just wants to say to the Minister of Defense, Ms. Nosizi and Oltando Mapisa Ngabulo, bravo, bravo, for recognizing the unsung heroes and heroines in colonial wars and resistance. This was at the Castle of Good Hope, 350, on the 9th of December 2016. So there is praise for especially the Minister of Defense for recognizing the Khoisan Nation Self-Defense Unit, including the recognizing of women leaders of the Khoisan people. Lastly, Chief Arendse, you said you'll be making a submission. We want to know when, because as soon as the public hearings are done, we should be considering all the submissions that are there. So if it's not next week, by next week, it means when we consider, we will just consider your oral submission, but probably we'll be missing out in some of what you would have wanted to submit on, as you say you'll be making a submission, including the proposal on how would you want to see new legislation being conducted and taken through, because you did mention that you must change the way that you legislate. So, but to everybody, is that there is a bill before us. There are clauses within that bill. What we'd like to see in the main is to you critiquing the bill and saying in this clause we'd want to see 1, 2, 3 and stuff like that, and whether you agree with the bill or you do not agree, but critique it and give us proposals, because it doesn't help to come and rehash the bill. It doesn't help to talk and tell us what is there. We want to know what is it that you think is not there, or what is it that you think must change. So those kind of submission would be very helpful. And also, it's good that you've been here since we started Tuesday, and you could see some of those who made submission speaks to the bill, different clauses, and what the proposals are. Yeah, so let me give you an opportunity to respond to those questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First and foremost, I think we did make a written submission in terms of the sum of our concerns. However, we are in a coalition with Nguni groupings and Busmans, so we had an opportunity created. For example, with the Bukhosans and the Khoza chieftaincies in the Western Cape, to physically have a set of resolutions parallel to some clauses that is proposing how partnerships should be factored in and more representative structures or approaches considered. So, Madam, by next week, before the public hearings is over, we will have a detailed clause-for-clause proposal submitted. But it will not be on behalf of the Kai Kurana alone. It will be on behalf of Nguni chieftaincies, the Kai Kurana, and the Bushman formations in the Western Cape. Why? For the last 100 years, when we look at our documentation dating back from 1890, from the mission stations in all these districts, the Ngunis were there with us. They were there. The Busmans were there, whether they were nomad. And to us, as Kurana, they are co-owners because they shared and lived those cultures with us. It is just today, unfortunately, people get confused and think that we never lived together. We did live together. That is what people must understand. So from our point of view, there is a lot of similarities between our IP and what we approach as IP from an educational point of view. So in that instance, we have to affirm a single submission from all of us on the basis of ceremonies, plants, vegetations.
and the question of alien vegetation, with the problem we have with that, with sand parks. There's other legislation like the NEMA legislation that should be consulted in this legal process, the amended Intellectual Properties Act. There's seven other pieces of legislation, all the way to the Customary Marriages Act, the proposed Traditional Courts Bill. So there are many legislations that should have an intersection with this in particular one, including the Kuan San Leadership Bill, that if in effect, if it is signed, it will repeal both Act 41 in its current form and the House of Traditional Leaders Act. All those things have adverse implications on our customary structures. Hence we are saying we had to go into a consultative period with people who can prove that they have been there for more than 100 years. And those people we know, that is why we entered into a coalition with them, are the Bikwasan and the Busman clans and the Nguni, the Xhosas in particular. Because we can prove each other's existence there in the Western Cape on paper. So in that instance, we first had to make sure we can prove proximity and the practicing of those customs. Then say to government, we need a public-private partnership to a greater extent, not to have over-regulation in certain areas, especially as far as NICSA is concerned, special emphasis on cultivation protectorates. Why? Because we have other legislation speaking to us as COI, which is the exceptions to the 1930 Native Land Act. In that, government has proposed agri-parks that we have accepted as a means of land restitution and rural development. Now we have to say to science and technology, we want cultivation protectorates. We want certain vegetation registered in the Western Cape that we have been practicing for longer than 400 years. That the thing is, we need those specifics to be understood, that that legislation should have an intersection when we identify regulatory practices such as licensing. So ma'am, I hear you, but I also have respect for the fact that this government has done better than any other on the African continent and the world. If you look at the unification of East and West Germany, if you look at a number of international events in the last 40 years, then this government has performed the best in terms of recovering from apocalyptic events in its history. This government had to clean up 480 years of total displacement. So what we are saying, we believe you do have the ability to listen to us. We do believe that middle ground can be found. That is our belief, so we will be making those technical submissions before next week. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The coordination, are you just based in Western Cape? You're not dealing with those, for instance, in the Northern Cape?
No, it's supported by those provinces, but the proposal is consolidated by the Western Cape. It is just signed off by the other provinces as well, because the similarities, there's no similarities. The Xhosa people from the Eastern Cape, they are Xhosa speaking. There's no difference between the IP, the practices, and the customs.
Thank you very much. Can I have Mr. Damon?
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, on that question on consultation, which was said to all the people that did presentations, consultation has been done by the DST on the IKS. But as somebody that were present at that first engagement which we had here in Cape Town, it actually only took 10 minutes. After 10 minutes, all groups that were invited were all disappointed with one single fact, and that is the first thing mentioned in the bill, the definition of an indigenous community. Since then, at that actual meeting, the officials of DST undertook that they were going to go back to their superiors and note to them that we had that problem. It was never done. No response since then up to now.
Which one is that, Mr. Damonso? Do you have the date, probably, or approximately?
Not the date, but Carol and Tom were the people that were present at that meeting. It was held at Joel's Park on the other side of Cape Town. Then on the coordination, your question, Mrs. Chair,
The Cape Bush Doctors is an organization representing indigenous healers from the Cape to the Kalahari. We are consolidated in all levels of governance, with chieftaincies, with traditional houses, indigenous groupings all over. We are one consolidated group representing all indigenous healers in South Africa. We have members from the Kwende Bushmen, the Nguni, even our colonials. That my point on the part, do we have partnership? Yes, we have partnerships with each and every one. Your other point on the governance and the part that government plays. Ria, I do not trust any government department with my indigenous knowledge. I'm going to put emphasis on that. Because from my engagement with government for the last 15 years, we are trying our best to help you guys to get somewhere. But we're always getting the bureaucracy that our consultation, that our submissions, that our words, what we speak, it doesn't actually count when it comes to your bureaucracy. Because your bureaucracy is directly in conflict with our indigenous and traditions. So it can never be, although we are trying. Like we have for the Department of Health and also the Department of Environmental Affairs. But also note that this is about my IKS, not about health or conservation like in the other departments. So to say that in the one point we're supporting government, in the other point we're fighting it, is actually not a true point. We're just fighting for ourselves and making sure that we stand for ourselves.
How do you see this public hearing?
Can I finish your question?
Helping you. I just want you to add that, how do you see then these public hearings helping or not helping you?
If I check this public hearing from where it is now, I'm not actually sure what it's going to do, because the process haven't ended. And as it has been started in the first place, with being flawed, where there was no consultation, where there was no economic impact study, done, and that you told to me when I was presenting to you in Pretoria, it was said from the committee that those things weren't done. So how do you expect this process, you yourself, to have any impact? So then, to come to your question, these government departments that we were working with, it is very uneasy, and it is actually very hard. Because for instance, when we are talking now, remember the example that I used. When the police finds me now with medicine, I go to jail. But here, you want to know what I know about medicine. So don't you should be actually cleaning up your own house before coming to me. Then you talked about the Khoisan Defense Unit. I'm a healer, not a soldier. That's a totally different thing to what we are doing here. Thank you.
The gentleman in front of you, please, this is from taking photos. So, you are here presenting to us. So it means you have presented, but you have no faith in what you have presented to us. So when we sit and consider your submission, how should we handle it?
When I do my submission, in your bureaucracy you have rules that people have to do these things. And I am doing it because it is part of your bureaucracy. Hoping and having the greatest hope that at least it would make a difference in the way you are doing things.
Mackenzie.
Madam Chair, I want to respond to the question about whether we support the bill or not in a very direct way. Because the West Cape Legislative Coalition Council has got legislation and legislative work as its core, we are, of course, committed to be part of that. So on that note, that's why we're here. In fact, it was good to be part of it. However, when you ask the other question as to, so who do you represent, I want to yet again just point out that we are sitting in the year 2017 on the other side of a conscious divide, rule, genocide, breakdown, and all of that process. So when we are talking the way we are talking and coming together, it is at the same time we do that. So the conversation is very complex insofar as we want to participate in legislation because that's what governance, that's how you govern. But on the other side, we are also dealing with the leftovers of the past in terms of coming together in a coherent manner. And we see the candle being burnt at both sides. In fact, it's actually multiple sides, not just two sides. So what is the position of the Western Cape Legislative Coalition Council is that we have it in our core to bring together the interest groups within a meaningful institutional framework. But it happens at the same time when we engage the current holders of the levers of governance and power. We are engaging that same entity to let it be known where are the weaknesses that is leading to us not talking meaningfully. I hear the previous speaker talking from his yielder's point of view, and I hear him clear, or I'm not going to suggest clearer than you, but I hear him loud and clear. But I can also see the gap that is required for what it is that he has, this frustration, is what we are doing as our work, which is this governance structure that must be in there to deal with things governance. So in short, the support for the process of getting to an IKSB that becomes an act, that is there. But it's not an easy conversation because it comes with history and it comes with multiple sides that sits there. With regard to the content, from the Western Cape Legislative Coalition Council's point of view, we have made mention of Ms. Pinto's presentation of yesterday as a marker. I want her to see, I'm looking at you, eh? I want her, because you weren't here earlier, we raise her example in terms of how she approached it. She approached it from the side of the people and from that side engaged the act. So we support that. And I'm sure in terms of further submissions from our side, we will engage the act in itself and we will make submissions if necessary.
Thank you very much.
I want to pause this. Thank you.
Thanks. Prof.
Thank you, Chair. Let me respond to his question. And the question had to do with whether we are in support of the bill. Yes, we are in support of the bill, and that is why we are here. And the presentation was to make a case for that support, because you cannot just say, yes, I support. You have to say why you support. And but it is difficult to say who do we represent. We're speaking on behalf of or for the, it's difficult to say because education is so broad, so wide. Who do we represent? But it is education, and specifically higher education. Because if we start with higher education and there could be commitment, what is lacking is commitment and support for IKS and higher education. We need that. I'm not sure if there is a portfolio within education on IKS, and that is something that really we need to look into, because we need to know that what we say is being done. And I think what I missed was to look at the draft, and I believe that there is a draft, and so whatever information is being put together will go into the final draft.
Yeah, also the issues that come, for instance, you raise issues of education, we have to engage with the portfolio committee of education to bring to their attention your concerns, yes. But we're looking at everything. Yes. But also to re-emphasize that this process, when it's done here in the National Assembly, it will be sent to the National Council of Provinces, who will be engaging, who will be in all provinces, they will conduct public hearings. So also it's another opportunity for you. I'm not going to take other hands, but I was giving opportunity to those who make presentations today. I just want to find out if Dr. Masipa has arrived. And Chief Sidas. Not here, okay. Professor Owen, then, yes, if you could come to the front and make a presentation, then.
Sorry, Chair. Chair, I had my hand up from right in the beginning of the questions session to answer a question, and I feel that I've been ignored through this process and now been cut off. I'd like to make a short...
From the committee members and to those who made presentations.
The answer is to Honourable Member Kurnoff's original question, which was directed to all presenters.
Yes. To the presenters.
Was made... His call was to all... presenters to answer his question, and I'm one of those.
And me.
Chairperson, if I can assist you,
yes.
My question was to the last presenters, not the presenters during my time. So, Mr. Rees, unfortunately, you were not included in my question. Mr. Van Breda took a inside, he's probably playing center, but nevertheless...
That was my understanding.
Chairperson, I ask that you recognize me.
Yes, Honourable.
I had a question that I wanted to pose to Mr. Darmans and Mr. Arendse. But if you will indulge me.
Okay, Honourable Paulson.
Thank you very much. Chairperson, I don't want to use this Eurocentric approach, but I need to get a sense as to the size of the community that both Mr. Arendt and Mr. Darmans are representing here. It's the one is the Cape Bush doctors, and I don't know how that fits in with the Khoisan, because at present I must admit, as with everyone else, or most of us here on the committee, we have limited knowledge as to how the whole Khoisan nation, the size of it, what it looks like, and how much or how many of them are really represented here. So I need to get a sense from both Mr. Arendse and Mr. Darmans as to how big their constituents are.
Okay, thanks. You're repeating your question. Mr. Damons, just can you respond to that particular question of how big is your constituents that you represent?
Okay. My organization, like I said, stretches from the Cape to the Kalahari. And it's all healers within communities. And if you can narrow it down to a place where we are today in the city. In the city today, you have about 25 healers working in different places in the city on the different markets. So that would kind of give you an idea if you take up how many cities and towns we have in Stellenbosch, but the whole country. It's ten hundreds of thousands.
Thank you. I always appreciate the question as a chicken and an egg question. Who was first, the chicken or the egg? Urbanization and social migration has played a lot in terms of how our chieftaincies are traditionally constituted. The Group Areas Act and the Bantustans played a big role in that. Just to answer the question, in terms of a district like Witzenberg, the Cape Town Metro. The old earth numbers of a town like Ravensmead, there was only 25 original earth numbers registered. It was called kraals at that time. If you look at Ravensmead today, there's about 60,000 residents, including Cravenby and Aitzer. So if you want to talk about the members, you must mean the descendants, which has been flavored in and out as the years went by. There was marriages between Kozars, there was marriages between Cape Malay, there was marriages between...
The question was, how big is your constituency?
Per district or in its entirety?
Entirety. How big is your constituency?
Well, we didn't keep membership since we're not an organization, but in the Western Cape we have 9,000 members because they had to write in, because it's a trust and an NPC, so it's 9,000 for the Western Cape. I cannot account for the other provinces.
Thank you very much. Professor Owen?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and all those present. I'd like to just give a brief introduction. I am a professor of law at Stellenbosch University. My field of expertise is intellectual property. I have practiced and still continue to practice as an attorney for the past 40-odd years, specializing in the field of intellectual property. I was a member of the A Committee, which assisted the Department of Science and Technology in drafting this bill, so I have played a role in its formation. I approve the basic principles and the fundamental approach of the bill. I think it's a very sound approach. It has a very strong merit that it is sui generis legislation. In other words, it's custom made to deal with the particular subject. Unlike the Department of Trade and Industry's Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Act, which has a different approach, and which I think is a wrong approach, and I've addressed this committee on that issue. I said then, and I say now, that frankly I don't know how this bill can coexist with the DTI legislation, because they both cover the same area of law and have totally different fundamental approaches, and to my mind it's like trying to mix oil and water. I don't see how the two can coexist, and as I've said, I think this bill is vastly preferable to the DTI legislation, and frankly my proposal would be that the DTI legislation is repealed. I say repealed because although it was passed by Parliament 3 years ago, it has not yet been brought into operation, and possibly that speaks volumes as to its value and its worth. Now, I have prepared this PowerPoint presentation, but before I go on to deal with it, I'd like to just digress in a sense for a moment to deal with some of the issues which have arisen in the discussion this morning, because with all due respect, in my view, there are some fundamental misconceptions flying around as to exactly what this bill entails and what it seeks to do and what the lie of the land is that is being addressed. In the first place, I want to pose a question, a rhetorical question. How does one protect interest, information or knowledge? And the answer is that the only inherent way that you can protect information or knowledge is to keep it secret, to keep it confidential. Once it gets out into the public domain, in principle, it is free for use by all. There is an inherent right to copy. And civilization over the eons has progressed by copying. It is a very natural process. The expression, why reinvent the wheel, comes to mind. The only way in which you can protect information or knowledge, is by means of legal measures. The law creates mechanisms by which you can protect that information. So this has been achieved in the case of intellectual property by various statutes such as the Patents Act, the Copyright Act, the Designs Act, etc. These statutes create private ownership of items of intellectual property. And by creating private ownership, you create the facility for the property to be used in commerce and to generate revenue and to make income out of it. That is what the fundamental approach is of intellectual property. Now, the traditional knowledge that we are talking about here and which is in this bill is at the moment largely unprotected. Aspects of it can be protected under the existing intellectual property statutes, such as inventions under the Patents Act, artwork under the Copyright Act and the Designs Act and so forth. But by and large, traditional or indigenous knowledge in its true sense is unprotected at the moment. Now, what this bill seeks to do is to create a mechanism for protection. It is creating protection where protection presently doesn't exist. It's a voluntary system. No one is being forced to come forward and register their property or what they claim as their property. If they want to continue as before for the past few hundred years, they're perfectly entitled to do that. They can rely on whatever methods they've relied on in the past to protect their indigenous knowledge. But if they want to gain the benefit of what is contained in this act, then they have to come forward and register it. NICSO is by and large in charge of the whole registration process. But NICSO is not a beneficiary of the commercial use of this material. NICSO is a facilitator. Before any use can be made by third parties of this knowledge which has been registered, a license has to be obtained. And one of the first steps for obtaining a license, or first steps, are firstly to get prior informed consent of the community that owns the intellectual property. So if the community doesn't want it to be exploited or commercialized, fine, it doesn't give that consent. And we stay where we are. The second requirement is that a benefit-sharing agreement must be entered into with the community. And the benefits which arise out of that agreement flow to the community. It does not flow to NICSO or to the state. It is the mechanism is set up in such a way as to entail the communities themselves to gain economic benefit out of the registration of this material. Now, the point, or the averment was made, allegation was made that this legislation enhances biopiracy. I frankly fail to understand that point at all. You are creating protection for material which was previously unprotected on a voluntary basis, and if you use it in order to gain protection for your traditional or indigenous knowledge, how can that possibly enhance biopiracy? So, as I say, there have been these comments made which I think are very wide of the mark, and I do think that I felt that it was necessary to make these few preliminary points before getting on with my own presentation. And my presentation is probably more along the lines of what you envisage, Madam Chair, in that I'm going to deal with specific sections and say what I see to be as problematic and suggest improvements to them. So it would be helpful if members of the committee could have a copy of the Act open in front of them so that I can refer to it and they know what I'm talking about. Now, firstly, I want to deal with the let me take a step backwards and say that, as I say, I participated in the drafting of this bill, and I do support it unreservedly. However, along the line, and I'm not quite sure where, possibly with the law advisors or where it happened, but certain gremlins or inconsistencies have crept into the text. And it is really these gremlins and inconsistencies that I'm going to focus on. Now, first I want to address the definition of indigenous knowledge. You'll see in paragraphs A to C, three different categories of intellectual or indigenous knowledge. Later on in the bill, and I've referred to the sections, a distinction is drawn between functional indigenous knowledge or cultural indigenous knowledge, which by and large is a handy way of looking at the situation. And the functional is meant processes, traditional medicines, traditional ways of doing things, and so forth. And the culture is meant cultural expressions, folklore, music, art, and that sort of thing. So that's the broad distinction between functional and cultural. Now, if you look at it carefully, in fact, paragraphs A and B are the functional component, and C is the cultural component. And I therefore believe that one must make the point in this definition that A and B are referred to as functional and C is referred to as cultural, and then that helps one to understand what these terms mean when they occur later in the Act. And as I say, I have given the references on the slide as to where these other occurrences happen. Next, I want to deal with the ownership of indigenous knowledge. The bill as it currently reads has vested the ownership of indigenous knowledge in the community from which it originates. And the community then appoints a trustee who, as it were, administers the indigenous knowledge on behalf of the community. There's a legal problem here, and that is that in law, a community is not a legal person. It does not have contractual capacity. And it therefore is anomalous for a community which is not a legal personality to own property. The way in which the committee on which I served originally drafted this issue was to say that the property vested in the trustee as the holder of the property for the benefit of the community. And that then makes use of the principle of trusts, which is a recognized principle in our law. And it then means that if, for instance, the community wants to enter into an agreement, the trustee, as the actual owner, can enter into that agreement. If the community has to enter into the agreement, it's a very difficult process. In fact, it's an impossible process because the community does not have contractual capacity. So my proposal is that we should revert to what the committee on which I served drafted in the first place, and that is that the roles are reversed somewhat. The trustee is appointed by the community. The trustee is the figurehead in whom the property vests, and his job is to administer it for and on behalf of the beneficiaries of the trust, which is the community. This is all quite technical, but I'm sure that the parliamentary law advisors can probably assist you in understanding this argument. And in keeping with this approach, the community should be designated as the beneficial holder of the IK. not the owner, but the beneficial holder. The trustee is the owner, and he holds it for the benefit of the IK, of the community, which is the beneficial holder. Next, I want to move on to the issue of IK practitioners. It's dealt with in Chapter 5, and here I'm suggesting a rearrangement of sections. I don't think it's necessary to go into the reasoning at this stage. I'll be happy to answer or provide any further information which you may require, but I've set out in the slide, which I'll obviously make available to the committee, what surgery should be done here to make it more consistent and to make it read more consequently. Now the bill makes provision for two registers. There's a register of Indigenous property, which is the main register, if one might term it that, and then there's also a register of designations. Now the register of designations comprises the Indigenous practitioners and the bodies or persons who are appointed to assess whether they qualify for registration as practitioners. That's dealt with in this separate register called the Register of Denominations. Now the way the bill is currently set up, it deals quite extensively with the main register, but it leaves the other register out in the cold to some extent. There's very little said about the other register, whereas in fact the general provisions which apply to the main register apply equally to this, let's call it the second register. And therefore what I've suggested here is once again some surgery and rearrangement so as to make the registers more easily identical, the two separate registers, and to make the provisions of the Act, procedures and that sort of thing, equally applicable to both registers and not only to the main register. Once again, I've set out all the sections here and I don't want to bore you with going into the finer points of the surgery that is necessary, but take it whence it comes, I believe that this surgery should take place. And then following on from that point, once again, it's more a question of surgery to get like things dealt with together and to have the Act read more consequentially. There should be a bit of reshuffling of sections in these instances as well. Now, as I said early on, one of the main purposes of the Act is to grant protection and to enable commercial activity in the material and to create a mechanism whereby income can flow to the communities arising from that commercial activity. And I've set out the relevant sections here. Now Section 5, if you look at Section 5, it gives a list of what the functions and powers of NICSO are. And you will look in vain to find the power to grant licenses or to set up the licensing system, which I think is a shortcoming. I mean, if you've got a section dealing with the functions and powers of NICSO, then that section should mention this very important function, namely the granting of licenses or facilitating the granting of licenses. So that, I believe, is an amendment which is necessary for Section 5. Then there's an inconsistency in the approach to the way in which benefit sharing agreements must be entered into. Section 13.3c says that someone who wants a license to use Indigenous knowledge must go to the community involved and enter into a benefit sharing agreement with that community prior to filing the application, because when he files the application for the license to be registered, the system makes provision for licenses to be registered. And when the application to register the license is registered, in terms of this section, there must already be in existence an agreement for a benefit sharing agreement. In contradiction, Section 26(1)(b) later on in the Act requires a standard benefit sharing agreement to be made with NICSA. So this doesn't gel. Either you are going to approach the community beforehand and get this benefit sharing agreement, or alternatively, you are going to negotiate the benefit sharing agreement with NICSA. And if you look at the way the Act operates, NICSA involves the community in the process of arriving at the benefit sharing agreement, but you can't have both. And my proposal would be to opt for the Section 26(1)(b). That the application should be filed, and then with NICSA's assistance, a benefit sharing agreement should be entered into with the community. And there's good reason for that, because I can well envisage that some communities are going to be rather unsophisticated people, and you might be dealing with major pharmaceutical companies or the like, and the playing field would be very unequal in that situation. So it is desirable that the agreements should be facilitated by NICSA. And it is envisaged that NICSA, or that a sort of a standard basic license agreement will be prepared and will form part of the regulations which will be published under the Act in due course. So that will all facilitate this process. I don't think it will work for the prospective licensee to go and negotiate direct with the community. Then it's implied in the bill that prior informed consent of a community must be obtained before a license can be granted. And that's a very important provision, because as I said earlier, the community must have the election not to make their indigenous knowledge public, or have it publicly used. But nowhere in the bill is it specified how and when this prior informed consent should be obtained. So that issue needs to be addressed. There is Section 26(1) which tells you when you don't require prior informed consent, and that's for education and that sort of thing. There's a whole list of things in Section 26(1). So it's the clear implication is that somewhere along the line, prior informed consent must be obtained, but it's not spelled out where and when and by whom that should happen. And this is not something you should really deal with in regulations. You should really set out the, let's call it the bones of the process in the bill, in the Act itself, and then the regulations can put meat on the bones. My next topic is the enforcement of rights. And if you look at Section 13(5) and Section 28(1), they basically say exactly the same thing. There's duplication. And I believe that this issue is out of place in Section 13(5), and it can simply be deleted because it is dealt with adequately in Section 28(1). Then there's an interesting aspect of this bill is that there's no provision made for any civil law enforcement, only criminal enforcement. Now, one can understand the logic of that, because civil legal proceedings cost money, and many of the communities obviously are not going to have the kind of money that is necessary to pursue civil litigation. So the approach of the bill is that the state will do the enforcement through criminal proceedings, which is a perfectly rational approach. It does, however, give rise to the situation that there's no ability to claim damages. Now that may be seen to be a shortcoming, that if transgression of IK rights has taken place, that the community should not be able to claim damages for that transgression. There is provision made for a dispute resolution committee, that's in section 27, and it has limited powers, and none of those powers include enforcement. So you can't go to the dispute resolution committee to determine that there has been an infringement of the right, but the dispute resolution committee has no power to bring any consequences to bear as a result of that finding. So it's a policy issue. Do you want the communities who own these items of property to be able to claim damages and pursue some civil proceedings, perhaps over and above the criminal proceedings, or do you not want it? And that election must be made. Then there is a section which is headed transitional arrangements, and this was alluded to by one of the speakers, pointing out that the section, section 33, makes it compulsory for IK to be registered within 1 year of the Act coming into operation. Now, I don't think this is a useful provision, because the policy of the bill, bear in mind that we're talking about knowledge or property that has been in existence for hundreds of years, and we are now seeking to confer protection on it. And, I mean, if one had to sit down and catalogue what all the items that can be protected, it would go into millions, if not billions. To expect all of that to be registered within 12 months is a pipe dream. But that's not the way the bill was devised, because certainly the way the committee on which I served saw it. Our view was that IK can be protected whenever it is made. If it was made, if it originated 300 years ago, it can be protected as of the day after this bill comes into operation, or 5 years after this bill comes into operation, but it must first be registered. So it is the registration which crystallizes the protection. The protection is inherent all along, but if you want to rely on the Act for that protection, if you want to use the Act to commercialize your property or enforce it, you have to go and register it. So the better approach, in my view, is to say, in fact, is to delete Section 33, because I think it nullifies a lot of the objective of the Act, and to rely on the principle that it is inherently protected, but to enable you to rely on that protection, you have to go out and register it. And then, as from the date of registration, it becomes concretized and can be enforced. Then a couple of general, fairly small points. What the Act says in Section 32 is that it does not detract from or interfere with any other legislation. So if you've got rights under some other legislation or obligations under some other legislation, they stay in place irrespective of what is in this Act. And that's a sound principle. It has to be that way. Certain specific acts are enumerated as being, or attention is drawn to them, that they are not being interfered with. And all of the intellectual property statutes, barring the Patents Act, is mentioned. And that is firstly wrong because patenting issues arise in this bill. And for instance, there is a section which says that nothing in this bill is going to impact on the question of prior knowledge, which is an issue in patent law. So what I'm saying is that the Patents Act should be added to that list of acts in Section 32.3. I mentioned the register of designations, which is treated a little bit like the poor relative in this bill. And there is a section there, Section 31B, where it should be specified. The bill makes provision for an advisory committee to advise the minister on all the issues pertaining to it, and it lists what the composition of that committee should be. Significantly, in my opinion, it makes no mention of lawyers. Now, it seems to me that since we're dealing with legislation and we're dealing with essentially intellectual property rights which are being created, to have an advisory committee which doesn't have any lawyers on it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So I believe that without wishing to advance the interests of my own profession, I think that it is desirable that lawyers should at least one lawyer should be on that advisory committee. Section 7.6 envisages a sound principle, but is nonsensical. It deals with the advisory committee. It has a certain number of members. They hold office for a certain period. And then it goes on to say that at least five of the members may be eligible for re-election. Now, if you come to think about it, that actually is nonsense, because at least five could mean the whole committee. And what if five aren't available? There's only three. So now you're saying, well, you can reappoint five, but you can't reappoint three. And I don't think it's necessary envisaged that you would reappoint the whole committee, or if you do want that to happen, say so. But to say you can reappoint at least five actually means nothing, in my opinion. So I think that section needs to be looked at. Then the remainder of this slide is really dealing with editorial issues where it's been left out and that sort of thing. So I don't see any purpose in going through that here, but I suggest that you take note of it, because it's just editorial. The is left out and that sort of thing. And I'll be happy to answer any questions which you or anybody might have, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Prof. Any questions from other members? Honorable Paulson and Honorable Baranoa. That order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. Prof, you never touched on Section 12, which in my mind is grants NICSA the sole right to own unclaimed indigenous knowledge or indigenous knowledge for which they can't find identify any community. And also, yeah, you've stated that that NICSA can also deny someone their application to own any knowledge or some knowledge. So they become the trustees of that knowledge and licensee. So they could sell that knowledge to pharmaceutical companies, big business. That's the one bad thing about it. The other thing is, what happens to the money they make from the sale of that knowledge? And
also there's no buy-in from communities when it comes to the sale of that knowledge. And I think that's problematic. And Nixo is actually going to have so much power to trade knowledge that they've acquired, and in the way I feel, actually bullied people from either, you know, taking ownership of this knowledge and not acknowledging true owners of this indigenous knowledge. And you haven't seemed to touch on that. And I think this is the, for most people who are opposed to this bill, this is the really contentious part of the bill, section 12. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Coroner.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a quick question. Professor, you're making the point that because there's no provision for civil law enforcement, you cannot embark on that road. Now, my question to you is it possible that if it's not mentioned here, that I will not have the right to embark on the civil law enforcement, you know, just in terms of the rule of law? Or do you think it is important to put it in here? My feeling is, if it's not here, I will go to the court in any event, but then the judges must decide whether I have a right for civil law enforcement. Am I correct or not?
Any other member of the committee? Prof. Owen? Prof.
Sorry, I might miss something.
Do you respond?
Okay, fine. Firstly, section 12. Look, what section 12 says is if there is a body of indigenous knowledge claimed by nobody, there is no indication at all of who owns it. In that situation, NICSO can grant licenses and can generate the revenue or receive the revenue that is generated. But should an owner come forward at a later stage, well then that owner can step into Nixo's shoes. Sorry? Well, that's what the section says. In the event that for as long as the holder of an indigenous property cannot be identified and designated, Nixo must act as custodian of that indigenous knowledge, and the ownership of it shall be deemed to vest in Nixo, which shall have the rights and obligations of a trustee in respect of that indigenous knowledge. So for as long as the ownership is unknown, once the ownership becomes known, that party can come forward and say, well, and stake its claim and say, look, we are actually the owners. In copyright law, you have a similar problem. They refer to orphan works. You, as a writer of a book, want to quote a passage out of another book, but you have no idea who the copyright owner is. You don't know how to find out who the copyright owner is. You've made all sorts of inquiries. There's no way of ascertaining who the copyright owner is. What do you do? And there is currently a proposal to amend the Copyright Act to allow the state to grant licenses in the case of orphan works. And that's commonplace. It's not an unusual provision in intellectual property laws around the world. It's a practical arrangement. I think the saving grace is the words "for as long as." If the impact of the section was that on a first viewing, no one knows who owns the property, therefore Nixo steps in, and whoever hereafter Nixo is the owner of that property, then you would have a complaint. But that is not what the section says.
The other question from Honourable Koronov.
Yeah, well, the role of Nixo, you spoke about buying in by Nixo. The role of NICSO is really a facilitator. It doesn't grant the licenses unless it is authorized to do so by the community. That relates to the prior informed consent, which I discussed. It's, in my submission, I said that it needs to be spelled out better than it is at the moment. But it is there. There is the requirement of prior informed consent. And so it's not NICSO can't issue a license if the community doesn't want the license to be issued. Moreover, the community also has to enter into the benefit sharing agreement. So if it doesn't want the process to happen, it simply refuses to sign the benefit sharing agreement. And without the prior informed consent and or the benefit sharing agreement, the process can't go forward. So the fate of that, of the use of that property lies within the hands of the community. NICSO is a facilitator. NICSO can't override the wishes of the community. Then the other issue of civil enforcement. If you look at all the intellectual property statutes, there are very extensive provisions as to what the powers of the courts are to grant interdicts and damages and all sorts of remedies. One talks of these forms of property that are created as being creatures of statute. Now, if you are a creature of statute, your existence is determined entirely by the statute. The content and the administration and what flows from the right falls must be dealt with four squarely within the Act. So if the Act is silent on civil claims and silent on enforcement, you can't go to court. The board's going to say, well, what section are you relying on? Please show me the section where me, the judge, is entitled to grant you damages. And the answer is, well, doesn't exist. There is perhaps a back door, and that is the law of unlawful competition. Common law unlawful competition has evolved to the point now where the court has recognized that if a trader trades in contravention of a statute, then someone who suffers damage as a result of the contravention of that statute can sue for damages. But that is a very indirect way of achieving the result that you may or may not want, namely the ability to make a claim. And it's a very vague area of the law. It's still developing. And if I was minded to ensure that IK owners should be entitled to have a damages claim, I wouldn't like to place my reliance.
Thank you very much, Honourable Paulson. I'm sorry, before Dr. Lautrec.
Thank you, Chairperson. Professor Dean, I would just like to understand this also, and maybe this is where the bit of a misunderstanding comes in terms of the vesting of rights and the whole question of trustees and NICSO being a trustee. You quite thoroughly discussed your problems with 12.2 and 3, where the we must look at the trustee appointed by the communities, then the holder, and the communities, the beneficial holder. But I think with 12.4, isn't it that perhaps people view that section as that all Indigenous knowledge, that where you cannot get to the holder of that becomes NICSO then takes management of that, but that in fact what this section implies is that only where someone now applies for a license to use it and the holder cannot be traced or found, only then does NICSO come in. So it's not a general taking over of Indigenous knowledge.
Don't lose sight of registration, because if Nixa wanted to assert rights in an orphan, let's use that terminology, an orphan item of indigenous knowledge, it would have to go and register it. So, because registration is the condition precedent for any action to be taken under this Act, even a license to be granted. So, Nixa would be hard-pressed to go and register every piece of indigenous knowledge around in its own name. And it would be, firstly, very expensive, and secondly, futile, because if other claimants come forward, then they're wasting their time and their money. So I don't think that it lays itself open to abuse. I think that the reality of the situation is that, let's say, a drug company comes along and says, we are aware that there is this piece of indigenous knowledge. We don't know who owns it or how we're supposed to go about it, but we want to use it. It's very important. It's going to cure AIDS tomorrow. How can we get to grips with it? In that situation, if no one comes forward and says, well, I own that traditional knowledge, indigenous knowledge, then Nixa can say, well, fine, okay, we will treat it as an orphan matter and we will register it and grant you the license. Registration, you know, the registration doesn't create the right. The right is there. The registration makes it, as I said, concretizes and makes it enforceable. But even Nixa, as I said, would have to register something before it could use it.
Thank you very much. Honourable Paulson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to follow up from my previous question. According to this bill, once it's signed into being, you only have 12 months to register your indigenous...
No, I've dealt with that. I think that's wrong. I think that section should be deleted.
Yeah.
I said that in my presentation. That section should be deleted because I say it's contrary to the policy of the Act. The policy of the Act is that all indigenous knowledge, no matter when it came into existence, is protected, and there is only one formal step that must be taken then, and that is registration, and that can be done at any time before you want to exercise that right. So I agree with you. I think I don't remember that the committee of which I was a part put that section in there, so I don't know where it came from, but I don't agree with it.
Thank you. So, because that would be in conflict where you say that Nixo can then issue or grant license for knowledge for which no one has claimed ownership yet and just give it back to the owners should they come along later.
Absolutely, that's why I say it's contrary to the policy of the Act.
The other thing is, let's say I don't register my intellectual or indigenous knowledge. I don't register it. And as you say, it may be a cure for AIDS. And yet I still practice using it. Would it then be illegal?
No.
So
this Act makes nothing illegal. It makes the owners continued interaction with his property and illegal. It simply creates rights. It doesn't take anything away. It's giving you a form, a method by which you can enforce your rights. Absent this Act, you don't have any rights. I mean, you can keep it secret. That's the only way you can prevent other people from using it. But once you've let the cat out the bag, inherently there is no way you can stop them absent legislation which gives you the power to do so.
Hello.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Prof. We now going to have a break of 30 minutes. No, I'm not allowing you. Can you please switch off your mic, sir? Please switch off for me. Thank you very much. We'll have a break of 30 minutes. There's lunch at the Palm Court in Mark's building. And then we will resume at 2. There's just two people.